Kia ora, good morning, and welcome to Fringe Radio. It's the last day of Fringe today, and it's been an amazing time. I think it's probably ready for us to end, because you can't keep going like this forever. So today's Sunday, the 16th of October. There's only three events today. At 2 o'clock, there's an event called Time for Our Stories, an orchestra performance by rangatahi who have explored their stories through drama, art, and music, and composed the music on show today. So that's pretty cool. I wonder if that's... It doesn't say, but I wonder if it's Whangarei music. The one down at the old library. The performance is at the old library, so guess it is. Expect a high-quality and genuine performance by rangatahi, composers, and musicians. Drama, dance, and art have been part of the creative process, so you could be in for a multifaceted treat. And that's a koha, and it's 1.5 hours. Starts at 2 p.m., at the old library, Time for Our Stories. And there's been a great range of, you know, family-friendly, child-friendly, donation-based events as well at Fringe, which is cool. The Imaginarium is on from 3, as always, 3:33, I should say. Not sure what they've got up today, but I'm sure you can find them on... I think they've got a page on Facebook. They have got a page on Facebook. And at 3:30 p.m., the second and final show of Blackadder the Golden Age, which I believe is sold out, and sold out yesterday, so that's great news for them. Big cast from Kerikeri, lots of people on the road, and lots of props and lots of costumes. Real big, large-scale production, the biggest in the Fringe, so it's going out. It's closing the Fringe, and then at 5 p.m. at Roost on Bank Street, there's the Fringe Awards ceremony. And everyone's welcome to that. So that's today, pretty much. So I thought what I'd do, I've interviewed everybody who I could possibly interview. I haven't had anyone from Time for Our Stories in, but it's a bit late now. I thought I'd just play back some of my favourite interviews from the 2 weeks that we've been doing Fringe Radio. They've been beautifully uploaded onto the Beagle Radio on beagleradio.co.nz. If you go to the Fringe Radio show page, and you can find the podcast uploaded to there, and running a list of who and the timing, who we spoke to and the timing. So if you want to find any of those, on the first day of Fringe, on the 30th of September, I spoke to Liam Asprey, who's the artist whose exhibition, The Affectionate Portraits of Furship, is at Megan Dickinson Gallery. And then a bit later, I spoke to Verena Schoen, who organised the Human Library. And then I spoke to Jojo Bellini, whose show Bondage Queen Sings the Hits was early in the Fringe. And then Pete Newland and Matt Kelly came in for some willfully obscure conversation from the show Intangential, which was a one-off poetry sort of mixed media type show. Then I had a reasonably successful phone conversation with Stephen Lyons from the Dice Show, and he also did a show called The Joyous Comedy Hour. That was by phone. My phone interviews weren't always very successful due to technical problems, let's not talk about it. And got to know Stephen a bit during the Fringe, because he seemed to be around a lot, and he's a great guy, very easy to talk to, got a lot to say, got an opinion on everything, but I guess that's stand-ups for you. Then I spoke to Vinyl Burns, a.k.a. Kim Potter, whose show The Power to Change Your Mind was an early Fringe show, which I managed to see. And then Michael Hockey and Sten Francis Deer came in. They were the performer and musician from To Be Frank. And then finally at 12, which unfortunately didn't make it onto the podcast because it stops at 12, was Anders Falsti Jensen from Back to Square One. So that was day one. And I thought since Verena has been such an amazing, well, not because of this, but also Verena has been an amazing part of Fringe, such an energetic and kind and well-organized person who not only has organized all the volunteers and done a great job, but she also organized the Human Library, which took place early in Fringe. I forget which day exactly. And so let's hear her talking about it. Fringe Radio playlist, which has been specially curated by Beagle Radio. And now I'm pleased to welcome Verena. Is it Sean?
Sean.
Say it again.
Sean.
So you do pronounce the P?
Mm-hmm.
Sean. You probably have to tell people that every single day of your life.
That's okay.
Where's that name from? Like, was it, is it a German name?
Probably Czech Republic, kind of that. But yeah, right. Germany.
Right. Okay, cool. So Verena is here to talk to us about the Human Library.
Yes,
okay.
I am.
So I think to a lot of people that's, you know, that won't be on their kind of radar, that concept. So can you tell us a bit about what it is?
Yeah, so it's an event that, in its essence, it's about unjudging people. So books with a lived experience of prejudice and discrimination talk about their life.
So the book is the human being?
Yes.
So it's sort of a metaphor, you're sort of saying that a human being is a... I know, like a repository of knowledge and experience, and,
yes.
And it's sort of accessing that.
Exactly. Okay. So they're called human books, and we've got a whole range of them. We've got a book about dyslexia, survivor of abuse, Iraqi, black in Aotearoa, transgender, Maori. And, you know, a few other books. So
you refer to them as books, not people?
Yes.
Okay.
They're human books.
Yeah.
And the idea is that readers, you know, come and go into a dialogue with these books for a little while.
How's it set up? Like, are they in a room, or how are they sitting in a public space? Or?
We'll do it at the library, so it is a public space, but we've got the whole first floor and all the tables on there, so people will go and have private conversations on those tables,
right.
So semi-private setting.
And do you book in? Do you book in to see someone, or do you just turn up and see what's available? Or?
You turn up and see what's available, basically.
Right.
We've got the help of our wonderful volunteer librarians who will match you with a book.
So, for example, if I walked in and I said I don't know if you call it reading a human book, but
yeah, you can.
You can. Because normally when you go to the library, you're quite specific about what you want to choose. So,
yes.
So how would you? So if I turned up, how, and I said I don't care what you put me with, what would you? How would you choose?
So the librarians will enter in a dialogue with you and ask you a few questions,
right.
And tell you a bit about how everything works and the rules as a reader, and then you can pick together with them a book that's available and that's
right.
of interest to you.
So is it like? So if I was there, would it be like an interview like this? Would I be asking the book questions, or would the book just be speaking to me pretty much
yeah.
You said it's a dialogue, so how does the dialogue work?
Good question. So our books all went through book training because the Human Library is actually, it's a huge organization. It's found all over the world.
Right.
And we went into a license agreement with them, basically, to be able to run it here. So we get this amazing structure around how to set up an event
right.
like this and how to make it a safe space and welcoming space for everyone. And the books will talk a bit about themselves. They have a little blurb about their lived experience. And then the readers will ask questions, and they'll go from there. And it's all about having an open mind and asking with genuine curiosity and interest.
On the part of the reader?
Yes.
The reader.
Yes.
Because it sounds from the description of the books that you gave at the beginning that you're sort of privileging marginalized voices. Would that be... Would
yes,
that be right?
Because it is, the whole event is essentially about unjudging, because we all have these labels in our head and we connect prejudices and just, you know, judgments with them. But we often don't have the actual discussion with people who have those as lived experiences.
Mm.
But it's also really hard to just weave that in an everyday conversation.
For sure.
Those questions that you really want to ask,
but
that you're afraid to ask.
So you've sort of got permission at the Human Library to ask questions that you might not ask in a normal everyday conversation.
Exactly.
And so how did you, have you been a book yourself, or?
No, I have not. Oh. Maybe at some point, but not at this point, because organizing this thing is full on.
Right, right. How many books have you got?
We've got 12 books at this point,
so are
which
they
is
all,
amazing.
Are all 12 at the library at that time?
Yes. So tomorrow at 9:30, from 9:30 to 12:30, they'll be at the library and, be available to borrow, so to speak, for half an hour.
It's a really interesting concept and I guess quite an unusual thing. Are you imagining that people will turn up to the library thinking that it's a normal library day and this will be going on, and do you anticipate that people would have to know about it and understand it before they arrived, or
Well, it's not a problem if they don't.
Yeah.
So we would hope that we get a few people who just come into the library to, borrow a normal paper book, and then they see that and think, oh, that's amazing. Yes, I'll try that. We've had a lot of good feedback from other people, just people who are really interested. But we don't ultimately know how many people will turn up because it's basically just a turn up and, read.
And so some of the books that you described at the beginning, are you able to tell us a little bit about some of those experiences, some of those books, or, sort of that confidentiality? You said that there's an Iraqi and a transgender person, and are you able to share anything about their stories to sort of like, or should we go there and experience it for ourselves?
I think experiencing it for yourselves is probably the best idea. But I can share a bit. We have a late diagnosed ADHD book, for example.
A late diagnosed ADHD,
yes,
so an adult person,
yes,
who's been diagnosed. Oh, interesting.
So in their 50s, basically.
Right.
And you'll find out all about how that has actually, not knowing that there is ADHD the history, that, and how that makes such a difference looking back, and all about this experience, like
sort
this
of understanding,
light bulb moment.
Right. Understanding some difficulties that person had in their life without the diagnosis, which the diagnosis sort of makes clear.
Exactly.
Oh,
same goes with dyslexia, of course, and then, we've got a court system, like somebody who went through the court system
as a person going through it, as a person with a not like a lawyer or a not someone
no
who
not
in,
a lawyer
oh,
somebody
someone who's been in criminal or other problem.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
And that will be a really, really interesting conversation as well. It's hard to, figure out what to say now, because I think ultimately you need to come down and because they need to speak for themselves.
Sure, absolutely. It's a really interesting concept, isn't it? Especially in our digital era where you're actually sitting down like we are now, face to face, talking to someone who's a complete stranger.
Yeah.
It's kind of well known the difference between the quality of that conversation and the conversation you might have online with someone, and kind of the rules around that.
I think it's really hard to judge people if they're in front of you and you're forging an actual, real, authentic connection. And this is what the Human Library facilitates in the safest possible way.
Right.
And I personally think that it's hard to get that online, even though it is, of course, possible.
Yeah.
But it's way easier to judge people if you don't look them in the eye.
Yeah,
for sure. So, I think it's really relevant. And, it has been around for 22 years all over the world.
Wow.
So, huge organization with, a lot of uptake.
And are all the books from Whangarei, are they people that you've sort of found locally who wanted to do this? Or
Yes, they're all in Whangarei or Dargaville.
I see.
They are from... Yeah, Northland.
How do you find them? How do you sort of recruit them, or how do you kind of...
Mainly through our networks.
I see.
Han, my co-organizer, they know a lot of people, and then I know if it's because it's such a unknown concept still.
Yeah.
It needs a lot of personal discussion before you actually enter into it as a book.
Yeah.
And you need to feel safe as a book.
Totally.
So that needs personal connection.
Great. Yeah. So it's one event tomorrow, 9:30 till 12:30 at the Whangarei Library.
Yes.
Okay.
Central
sounds
Library.
Sounds really fascinating and quite unusual, kind of an unusual thing to do.
We hope to do a few more in the future, but for now we'll try this one and see how we go.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for coming in, Verena. Verena is also the volunteer coordinator for the Fringe Festival, so quite a full-on time.
Yes.
But I'm feeling excited. This is kind of, I feel like this is where the fun really begins.
Yes.
So that was Verena Pschorn talking about the Human Library, which was on Saturday, the 1st of October. That was great. Even though I didn't make it down there, by all accounts, it was a really interesting, it's a really interesting concept. Okay, I'm going to play a track while I line up the next interview. And this is, apparently it's the 10th anniversary of Lonerism by Tame Impala, which was one of my favorite albums for a very long time. So I'm going to play Mind Mischief.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Fringe Radio. That was Mind Mischief by Tame Impala from their album Lonerism. Great album. Okay, so I've really enjoyed talking to stand-up comedians this Fringe. I have to say, you can't offend a stand-up comedian, and they're desperate for you to like them, so they work really hard in interviews. God bless them. And I've maybe become a bit of a connoisseur of stand-up comedy. And luckily, I finished up the festival with two really great acts. Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber were amazing, and I really enjoyed the interview with them yesterday as well. And Advait Kurtikar from the show The Awkward Indian Guy Act, he was great. Like, he was just really unusual and funny and, just off out the gate, but in a very sort of subdued, calm, controlled way. Okay, so I'm going to play one of the first interviews I did with stand-up comedians was, I remember enjoying it. I don't know if it's a great interview, but Gavin Hewitson and Thomas Chapman came into the studio, and here we go. Back. This is Fringe Radio. I'm Damien, and that was God Only Knows by the Beatles. And I'm very pleased to welcome now into the studio Gavin and Thomas, who are the performers from Elevator Comedy.
Yes.
How long have you guys been working together?
Oh, 2 nights. And,
I see.
But we've known each other for like a really long time, just doing stand-up together.
Right.
And I was like, this guy's terrible. Let's do a show.
This guy is around.
Makes you look good if he's terrible. Is that the way it works?
You'd think so.
I'm going to be opening up, and then he's like, "I got to save this gig now."
Let's go. See. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So do you do a separate piece each, or how does it work? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Each half an hour.
Yeah, okay. Just each half an hour. Straight stand up comedy. Just making some jokes.
Right.
I mean that's pretty much stand up off the wall, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So where have you been kind of working? Like, where did you get to know each other?
Auckland mainly.
Yeah.
He's been doing gigs like up and down the country for a while. I've just been in Auckland basically.
Right.
And then just going to Hamilton and here, and we're like, oh, that goes. Want to do a show?
Right.
And that's how it happened. Yeah.
There was.
Yeah, we just,
no real planning to the whole thing.
And being a stand up comedian, you know. Really, you don't have a lot of sort of like, it's probably logistically quite easy to do stuff like that. Like, it's just basically just you and a microphone.
Yeah,
that's the.
It's pretty much, and sometimes an audience, you hope. But I've done.
That's why we're here.
Yeah.
We've got two of the three things. We just need the third.
It's
stand up's one of those great things you can just do pretty much anywhere.
You
jump into a bar somewhere, you say, yeah, let's check up a speaker.
Yeah.
You know, get some chairs in. Yeah. And it's great.
So, how did you two get into it? Like, how do you become a stand-up comedian? I was thinking that the other night when I was watching. I was at the Dice Show.
I
was thinking,
we were there.
I was there. I was a bit noisy at the beginning, and then I calmed down.
I remember you. You had a bit to drink, didn't you?
Oh yeah, more than I. Yeah, I didn't really. Yeah, I just sort of when that other drunk guy said it started going, I was like, oh, I don't want to be that guy.
I didn't even recognize you, man. Yeah. Good to see you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, but it made me wonder, like, when do you actually decide? Like, what is it? Feedback from other people? You go, like, people think I'm funny? Or is it, like, what's this? How does it happen for you guys?
I was failing university.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Sorry.
Can we swear?
Yes, you can swear on Beagle Radio.
Oh, yeah, awesome.
I mean, we encourage swearing.
Okay, failing a university degree and just being like, well, I got nothing left to lose. And then you're like,
what was the degree?
Engineering.
Oh, really? That's quite an easy degree to fail, isn't it?
Like, oh, yeah.
It's quite an intense.
And if you know me, you get why I shouldn't be an engineer.
I see.
I am not focused. I went to the wrong place coming here, and then had to run up the street. I'm very sweaty currently.
So whose idea was engineering?
I was good at physics, and I was like, I thought that was like, yeah, that's it. I hated uni, though.
Oh, right. What, too demanding, too intense, too...
Probably laziness.
Yeah.
It's like therapy at this point.
Yeah.
So what's your relationship with your mother like? I actually kind of want to know. I love your mother.
You haven't met my mother.
I'm sure I'd love her.
So you're failing at uni, then what? Like,
I like comedy, so might as well give it a go.
So you went to see a lot of comedy and thought...
I watched it on, like, YouTube.
Oh, okay, who did you like?
Frankie Boyle. And this guy called Sean Rouse.
Oh, yeah.
Frankie Boyle was a British comedian, Scottish guy. Real angry.
Uh-huh.
does political stuff, which I can never do. I just have know nothing about politics.
Right,
but
right.
I was like, I like that.
Yeah. Right. So he's right. And so, what? Who's the other guy? Sean Rouse.
Sean Rouse. He's an American guy. He's dead now, but he was. Yeah, just he was from the South, and he just had, just really just dirty jokes.
Oh.
And it was just he had like arthritis.
Oh.
So he was on stage, and he'd get carried on stage sometimes, and then he would just sit down in this chair and be angry for an hour,
right.
And people would be dying laughing, and I was like, that's awesome.
Right.
That he's just, he seems to be living in spite of people just to do the jokes.
Living in spite of people. Oh, I like it. How about you, Gavin? Who are your kind of inspirations?
Thomas Chapman is definitely one of my biggest inspirations.
Tell us a bit about him.
He's a bit off.
Like, great. Do you mean like inappropriate, or
I feel like he's very appropriate with me.
Oh, this is Thomas Chapman.
Yeah, Thomas Chapman. Sorry, my partner for comedy.
You lost me there. I was assuming
he's doing a bit of promo, baby.
Promo. Okay, tell us about Thomas's comedy.
Thomas is
angry? I mean,
no. Thomas's comedy is very funny. We'll leave it there.
Well, let's not explain it further.
I can't quite
swear it's funny.
I don't quite know how to wrap up what your comedy is, to be honest. Like, it's like funny anecdotes that just like you get yourself into these just like insane situations that are just like, they're just laughable, you know, and it's just
I say yes to slightly too much stuff, and then well, in it, I'm like, why am I here?
Right.
You should tell about that story you were telling me about the
sleeping in a ditch.
No, the one we were talking about on Friday night.
Oh,
no, it wouldn't be appropriate for radio.
Well, you know, it's Beagle Radio, so we don't have advertisers to upset.
Okay.
Luckily, so go ahead if you want to. Like, it's nearly.
How many people listen?
We don't know, but we don't care. I mean,
do you want to tell?
So, I don't know where to start with this story.
Do you want to start with it?
Yeah, you start. I'll fill in the blanks.
All right, so Thomas and I, we were talking about crazy sex stories.
Crazy sex stories.
And,
I don't know which one you're going for with it.
the orgy.
Oh, the orgy.
And like Thomas, and can we talk about this?
Yeah, of course. We don't have advertisers, so we can say what we like.
And then I think Thomas was saying he's got.
I'll tell it.
He's had more weird sex than he's had normal sex.
Oh,
which just means he's had weird sex once.
Hey, but it's a great story.
Okay, let's hear it. Let's have it.
So I was 18, failing university. It's during this time I was trying to figure out what to do.
Were you ever doing well with university?
No. Okay.
I went in bad. I did great in high school. Just after that, it was like, no.
Okay.
And you know how newspapers have the classifieds at the back?
Yeah.
Where it's
sex like, classifieds. Yeah. Yep.
It's the oldest form of like.
Yeah. Does it still
in the world. Of pervy.
Does it still happen?
Yeah, I didn't know it was still happening, and I was bored reading a newspaper with my family, and I going through them, laughing at them because they're very funny.
Yeah, it's like sex workers advertising themselves.
Yeah, because it's sex workers advertising it, and right next to the classifieds is also like a children's bookshop day, right next to each other, and you're like, this seems too close.
Yeah,
together. And I was looking for it, and I saw an ad for an orgy.
Yeah.
And I was like, this can't be real.
Was it like an orgy that you pay to go to?
No, it was just...
Yeah, so you know it's good, right? It's free. Nothing better than free orgy. Right?
Oh.
Okay, so you
no saw... overheads at all.
Just a lot of heads.
So you saw the ad for the orgy, yeah.
And I was like, why not?
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, so I was like, okay, and then I tore out the bit of paper... made sure my parents didn't see what I was doing.
You're like Charlie in the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is funny. I'll keep it for a set. No. golden ticket running down. And then just later that night, I was like, I didn't believe it. And then I just went to this apartment building, rang a door, and they were like, you're here for it? And they were. I was like, yeah. And he was like, sweet, come up.
And what were these people like?
All models. 10 out of 10.
I
thought I heard Thomas say old, and immediately...
Yeah. Well, you gotta... It's free and in downtown Auckland, which...
Well, doesn't happen often that free things happen in downtown Auckland?
No. So the class of people is a big range.
How many people were in the apartment?
There was like 4 women and like 8 men.
Oh, it's surprisingly not a good ratio.
One boy.
Yeah. But I was thinking for an orgy from a paper, a surprisingly good ratio.
Well, fair enough.
I was expecting that it should be only dudes, and I was like, I'm in the wrong situation.
Oh, you're expecting it to be only dudes?
Well, I was like, this can't be the thing that straight people do.
Yeah,
it's got to be.
Yeah, like a gay orgy or something.
Right. Of course.
Right.
But it didn't specify in the ad whether it was a gay or straight orgy?
No, I didn't. No.
Just said orgy and they gave the address.
Yeah, it gave the address and the time.
I admire you for going this far with it. Most people would have gone.
He went a lot further.
Okay, great. Yeah. I'm hoping that he did.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not great radio.
I know. And you get in and everyone's nude. And I was on time because I didn't know you could be fashionably late.
Unlike today.
Everyone was naked.
Yeah, everyone was naked. So you get naked.
Yeah.
And then you just... nothing was happening yet, though. Everyone was just kind of milling around like it was... like drinks and
with no clothes on.
Yeah, just no clothes.
Talking about stocks, investment opportunities in the lower
real
inside.
Upper class people. Yeah. Yeah. They're into crypto real early on.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'm a bit distracted by your balls hitting my legs.
So you get this
Bitcoin thing though.
you were comfortable. You're comfortable enough taking your clothes off.
I was 18. Everyone else was over 50. I was like, oh. I look great right now. This is
the only time Thomas has been the most alpha dude in the room.
I was like, I'm hot here.
Okay. I mean, surely this is where you get your material for stand-up. Like, you have to actually go out and have these experiences.
Thomas is like, I'm getting laid today, boy.
Okay, so keep going.
Fresh meat, ladies. Who is this weird boy here?
You kick you out, man. No. No one checked his ID.
No, they just let you in.
Checked his ID. Okay.
It's in a paper.
You could have been involved in a crime if they didn't check your ID.
So when did the action start then? Like, let's get on to
like 7 o'clock sharp. They were like, hey, let's all move into the next room. And then everyone just started. And it was like one bed where everyone was... Either
it was a
Adam
single
sex.
Bed.
Really?
It was a double.
Right. So everyone was on this double bed, either having sex or what? Watching people.
Oh, and
people.
Everyone who wasn't having sex was just kind of standing around, just waiting in like a weird queue.
Was it erotic?
No.
It was awful.
I mean,
I was hard on the basis I was 18 alone.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. So you managed to... get it up, which is great.
And I'm a boy.
Right, fair enough. So
I don't have those problems yet.
Okay, great. You weren't.
Are you looking for tips, mate?
No. Well, I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like for me, and I'd be like,
oh yeah.
That doesn't sound a very erotic
kind of situation.
Then, but anyway.
And then I just had sex with two of these ladies.
Great.
And then I was like, and then I came and I was like, oh, well, I'm going to leave now because once you come, I don't want to be here anymore.
I think it's called post nut clarity. Yes. Have you heard that? Have you heard that phrase?
Yeah.
Post nut clarity on the wall.
Oh, yeah.
So you left and
some other dudes on my foot.
They let you leave? They like,
yes. Oh.
Yeah.
They didn't say, wait, we're not done with you yet.
Come back. You're the sacrifice.
Yes. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
We're going to make a voodoo doll out of you.
That's hilarious. Okay, is that in your show, that story?
No.
Oh, my God.
That's just something I say for friends and radio.
Something for close friends and radio.
Yeah. Yeah, all the listeners, my close friends.
So Gavin, is Thomas's style of comedy, is that how he kind of gets up and tells anecdotes?
That's pretty much it, to be honest.
Yeah, that's...
That was his thing. I just love how I kind of set you loose there, you know? I really put
and
you
I
in
guess,
it.
I guess, you know... The thing I've noticed about comedians, you have to be fearless, don't you? You have to be prepared to go there. That's why we go to comedy. We go there for the unsayable things to be said.
Yes. Yeah,
and if you sense that the comedian's either unwilling or afraid to do that, then it's kind of a letdown.
Oh, yeah.
But
we're terrified after. When we get off stage and we're like, wait, why did I say that?
Oh, I see.
Like some of that post-nut clarity. After you get off on stage, you're like, wait a second.
Okay. So... So when was your first gig? Like, when did you first step on the stage and say, okay, I'm a stand-up comedian now?
Week before the orgy.
was it?
No, it was like a month before the orgy. Christmas. Christmas. In like 2018.
Okay.
And so then I didn't do it until like mid of the next year.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how did the first gig go? Did you come off and go...
Okay enough that I was like, yeah, I can do this. Yeah.
Cool.
But I've listened back to it. It's not good. I was delusional.
Really? So you've got better since then?
Yeah, I would hope.
What's the getting better? Like, what are you... Better material? Better timing? Better what?
Better material and then just learn how to write a joke.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Because you're funny when you start.
Yeah.
But you don't know how to tell people. You're,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm funny, trust me.
Yeah.
I don't think everyone is funny when they start, though. I think one of the big things is, like, figuring out how you're seen by the audience,
yeah.
right? And then just putting yourself in contradicting scenarios to that. Like or with you, I mean, maybe not. but it's really much like figuring out what your character is on stage.
Right.
And then...
So it's a persona that you...
I think it's a persona that is shaped by how the audience sees you. It is informed by how the audience sees you, and then you dial it in according to what you want to say and how you want to deliver it.
But it's still fundamentally you, isn't it? It's still fundamentally Gavin. It's still fundamentally Thomas.
Oh, it's a version, at least for me, it's a version of myself.
Okay. What kind of version? Like a...
A funny one. yeah, you'd hope. Yeah.
So how did you find out you were funny? Like, when did you realize that?
What orgy
Vietnam,
knocked it?
Yeah, Vietnam, 1976. I was in the trees. No, I had...
You were in the trees?
Yeah.
Switching sides.
Were you that kid at school that was always a little shit?
I was definitely funny. Well, come on. I was definitely funny in school. Like, definitely like the class clown sort of thing. And like, for me, I don't know, just doing dumb shit in school. Mm. And then I think I did stand up first time in 2018 as well.
Oh, yeah.
Where was that? September in Wellington. Uh-huh. Fringe Bar in Wellington. Great bar if anyone's there. Go check it out. If anyone's listening in Wellington right now.
It's called the Fringe Bar.
Fringe Bar.
And it's like a good place for... They do open mic nights and stuff
open
like that?
Open mic, just great for stand-up comedy, performances in general. Always shout that place out. So good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I went up on stage.
Cavern Club also good.
Cavern Club's also good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're next to each other.
They're right next to each other. But yeah, I did stand-up.
What were you doing in Wellington? Like, why were you there?
I grew up there. Yeah, I grew up there. Yeah, yeah. So I'm American, obviously, but my... my parents moved there when I was like 9, and so we just lived there for most of my life.
Also failing at uni, or were you just...
No, I was actually very talented.
Very talented.
Yes, and then I decided to do stand up.
Right,
and boy, real
drains from you.
What were your career options at that stage before you?
Honestly, like I was doing, I did a history degree. I joke about that.
Were you gonna just go and work at Tapapa?
Yeah, I did a history degree, and then I finished that up, and then like 2018, I finished my degree in like 2018. I finished my degree, and then I started doing stand up throughout that period, and then just did it. I got an office job when I was working at Ministry of Business, Innovation, and Employment, and I fucking hated it. I really fucking hated it. Yeah. Yeah, it was just so boring and
soul destroying.
Really was, just like real draining, and then. I remember this one time I got this catering company. I lost them a contract. You want to hear this story?
Yeah.
All right. So I was like a personal assistant at MB. It was just like the least masculine job. You know what I mean? Like, yes, Mr. Campbell. It was just like me and like a bunch of like 45-year-old women. Like, we would all just like shit talk. I got into it though. I really went into like the fucking...
Hey, the gossip and
everything. It's great. Like,
shit talking the boss and...
100%. It's just, you know, and they're all like... It's terrible.
Why else do you work other than to shit talk the boss?
Other than shit talk. Well, literally, yeah. But anyway, so there was this one woman who had like been at MB for like 15 years, right? It's like a long time, career kind of deal. She was finally leaving. And it was my job to organize all the catering for this group.
Yeah.
And I ordered it for the 18th, right? At least I thought I did. Right? And so the 18th is a Friday. And they call me on the 17th and like, hey, your food's here. It's like $500 worth of food, right? They're like, your food's here. I'm like, oh my God, no. So I run down. I'm like, you got to help me out. Like, what am I going to do here? And they go, well, you can either buy it again. And I was like, well, then I have to pay for it myself. And I'm not doing that. And they're like, oh, or you could try and like reheat it the next day. I was like, holy shit. So I get all the food, right? And I'm like, I have to store it somewhere. I have to store it somewhere safe.
I hide it.
Hide it. Yeah, yeah. I got to hide it somewhere safe.
Smuggling food.
Yeah. And so I go to the cleaners, at the building.
Yeah.
And they have like a tiny fridge, uh-huh. and I have to get them to move all their food out of the fridge so I can store like all this $500 worth of food, go to bed, because I have to, you know, it's the next day.
With all the cleaning supplies.
Yeah. It smelled like Dettol. The food tasted like Dettol. I go back the next day, and I'm there at 9, right? And the thing's at 10, so I have to heat up all the food. I'm like, all right, that's an hour. It's plenty of time to heat up all the food, right, in the oven. I'm heating up. It doesn't heat up. It's just getting longer and longer. Because like, I have 5 minutes before the thing. The food's still cold. And I'm like, oh, my God. So I just slam it in the microwave, blast it. And then we go up, take it all up for like, you know, like 100 people are there for the spread.
Oh, that many people.
Yeah, it's like a proper thing, right? Yeah. And then they're all eating it. And like half of it's still cold and stuff like that. And then I fully just blamed the catering company. I was just like, yeah, ooh, these guys really messed up the order. Never ooh again.
That's a shit thing to do.
Yeah, but, you know, I needed a job.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah. Then we'll get fired.
I quit after. I quit after.
Well, so you lost in the contract and then you quit?
Yeah. Okay. Come see my comedy show tonight.
Does that make it into the show?
No, that does not. I haven't told anything that makes it into the show, to be honest. I don't feel like anything should be making it into the show, quite frankly, after our... yeah.
What do you mean? How do you top Thomas's orgy, or like?
I got some other stories.
Yeah, Thomas's orgy is a good story. I don't have any stories like, you know. No, I don't really have any crazy.
So what is your stuff like?
Okay, I've had enough of those two. That was Thomas Chapman and Gavin Hewitson talking about their show Elevator Comedy and lots of other things. I'm going to chuck a track on while I line the next one up, and I think I'm going to play the interview with Cicada because there's some songs in that, and I remember really enjoying that conversation. So this is all a bit. It's all a bit about me and what I had fun with, but why not? Okay, so this is a track called Grounding.
We're gonna step down low to the basement floor. get down to see, get down to play. Turn it and put out, shake it up on the series.
Okay, that was Grounding by, what are they called? Langoff and Dafons from the album Grounding. I'm going to play, next I'm going to play the interview, or some of the interview that I did with Patrick Biss from Cicada. And Pat's show was on the 5th of October. And here we go. 12. Had some great guests on today, and if you missed it, you can go to the after. Give us a little while, but Ursula is uploading the what would you call it? Schedule, set list, whatever you call a show list, and putting it on the Beagle Radio website under the Fringe Radio show page, and you can just find the spot that you want to listen to and play it back. So thanks a lot for doing that, Ursula and Dave. Great remote technical support. And thanks to Matt for coming in and trying to bail me out this morning when I had a technical nightmare. So since then, it's gone really well. And next up in the studio, we have Pat Biss. Is that what you go by?
Yeah, usually.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. Welcome back. Pat's been in this studio before. Notably as a Beagle DJ, probably how many years ago was that?
I was like 14 or 15,
right.
4 or 5 years ago.
Right. Okay, so. And you don't seem terribly keen to talk about it, but
I don't know if any of that's been archived, but if it has been,
destroyed.
Do not find it. Don't go looking.
Okay. Well, I mean, Beagle Radio's had it's a very inclusive, co-pupper, so.
Yeah.
But we don't actually have many high school. We used to have at the beginning. There were lots of high school teenagers doing shows, and that hasn't. They tended to fall away quite quickly. They tend to come in, do a few shows, and think, "Oh well, that's that," and I'll do something else, which is fine. Anyway, excuse me. So Cicada have got a gig here tonight, and I was saying earlier your description in the program is very appealing to me. Somehow, it's sort of. Shows that you're not taking yourself 100%, you're not being too self-important and serious.
Yeah, I think, and I'd imagine any small musician or any sort of not very, how do I put this, successful artist will understand the feeling of there is nothing more weird than having to sit down and write an advert for yourself.
Yeah.
And it does feel like, because I tend to feel really awkward about having to talk myself up in some ways. And that sounded really full of it when I said it. It was like, oh, I'm so humble. I'm the most humble person on the planet.
Yeah. I think you're overthinking it, Pat. Yeah. But no, don't worry.
But no. And so sitting down and having to write, you should come to my gig and listen to my music and things like that is always a weird and slightly uncomfortable thing.
But at the same time, your kind of, I guess your sort of personality and your sense of humour comes through a little bit, you know, when you say another night of angst, obnoxious left-wing soapboxing and broken strings. I mean, you know, that to me, that shows that I'm you know, it's not someone who's, I guess that's sort of humility and maybe a bit of false humility as well. But how many people will be on stage tonight? Like how many are in the band?
Yeah, so... that's the unfortunate. There's some false advertising tonight because I was under the impression that this was going to be, I was going to be able to find members of my old band in Whangarei, but they're scattered across the country at the moment.
Oh.
And I also realised I was only going to be able to get here one day before, because I live in Wellington at the moment. Mostly.
Oh, I see. Right.
So. What was going to be a performance with a few people sort of walking on and off stage when I initially imagined it has since become just me.
Because that was a long time. It was like the beginning of August, wasn't it, when you had to register for the Fringe?
Yeah. So right. So I put potentially more than one person on stage and have failed to live up to that sort of half-assed promise.
Well, it's $10 or koha, so... You know, I don't think anybody's really got the right to demand their money back. They might not have paid anything in the first place.
You lied to me.
Yeah.
There's no one playing bass or like a snare drum. I want my money back.
So when you did have the band, was that your... What kind of instruments did you have?
Well, that was guitar, bass, drums and keyboards.
Right.
And, yeah, I quite like playing as Cicada because it means... It isn't... Like, having a name like that, it means that it sort of could be a band or it could be just one person.
Mm. Yeah.
And
you've been Cicada for a while, haven't you?
Yes. I was Cicada from when I started, like, uploading bad little songs to YouTube. Again, I don't know if all the archives exist, and if they do, don't look for them. and I didn't want my name on them because I didn't want people to be able to Google Patrick Biss and it comes up with that.
Right.
So I was... Cicada after a Tumblr post, which was just like a little, listen, if cicada larvae can live underground for years and years and years and only come up to just scream their heads off and then die, then so can I, damn it. And I was like, that's great, I'm stealing that.
So that's the sort of, the background to the choice of Cicada. Is that what they actually do, live underground for...
Yeah, for about 17 or 18 years, cicada larvae just live under the ground and then they come up and scream their heads off. To attract a mate, and I don't see why anyone would. If I were another cicada, I wouldn't hear someone just going. don't know how that sounded on the microphone.
That I think it was pretty good. So you're based in Wellington now. So are you performing as Cicada in Wellington as well?
Yeah. The last year, I sort of went into things and went, okay, I'm gonna. So I went to, and that's what. That album that we just heard something from was me sort of thinking I was going to become another sort of folk singer type. And that's what a lot of this gig tonight's going to be. But I sort of realized there that a lot of that has been done, and a lot of the gigs that I want to be sort of doing moving forward are with a band and with a sort of more of an energy to them. And
right.
Also, there hasn't been a functioning folk scene since the 60s.
This country?
Yeah.
Really?
There used to be something of one in Wellington, as I understand it from... But, and then I got dragged to some clubs by a friend, and it was sort of not my music at all, but it was, like, the energy in the room and people dancing and things, and I sort of had a sense
dancing
of,
to live music?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And I just
in sort, Wellington?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And I had a sense of, oh, okay, I want to form a band then.
Yeah.
Because, like, performing on stage on your own has its benefits. You can...
You're more in control, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And there's a sort of a... From seeing solo performances and from performing solo, there's a different energy to it, and there's a sort of an appeal to standing up and doing an entire set on your own, or to watching someone do an entire set on their own. But, I sort of decided I want... But there's a fun... and an energy in being in a band. And so I decided that I wanted to form some kind of a band. And then it's taken me about a year to get around to doing that. So I haven't been properly gigging, and this will be my first proper, like, play a whole long set to an audience where, like, the actual event is
right,
rather than just, hey, do you want to play a few songs? We've got a gap in the set,
yeah,
sort of a thing.
Right, I see.
So
when you're getting a band together, how do you recruit people? How do you, like, what's the sort of, what's the genre? Like, what kind of band would you be?
I feel like what I ought to do is find decent musicians, but I, or something like that. But what I've ended up doing is just sort of meandering around, finding people who are sort of fun to be around.
And yeah.
Sort of become more of a friendship than a...
That probably is...
Not that, to say that the people aren't decent musicians, by the way, if they're listening, which I don't think they are.
But it's probably a more realistic, you know, getting a bunch of very competent musicians together, you know, aren't necessarily going to get... There's something, you know, there's got to be some sort of chemistry, hasn't
there?
Yeah.
And I've been reading... Jarvis Cocker has a book called Good Pop, Bad Pop, where he talks about, like, being a 15-year-old in his first band, and he has this comment of really how everyone should learn music is by wanting to do something for the fun of it and sort of thrashing around in the dark a bit.
Yeah.
And because this new band isn't really in any state to be gigging yet.
Does it have a name?
Yeah, it's just going to be Cicada again.
Okay, right.
It's too much of a habit for me to drop at this
Fair
point.
Enough. Yeah.
There's a sort of a... But going back to everything and just being like, okay, let's play these chords and mess around and eventually find something that sounds okay. And just getting right back into the fun of that has been wonderful.
Cool. So how long's that been going on since you've been down in Wellington? Have you been sort of...
Yeah, it's... I've been trying to find people to form a band with for a while, and it's been a bit of a mess, but we've been rehearsing and writing together and things like that for a couple of months now.
Great. Wellington's a good place to be doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just more people, more venues, more everything.
Yeah, yeah. I love... I was talking to Matt just outside before, saying a lot, but...
It's okay, it's Beagle Radio. Yeah. Swearing and ums are okay.
Hell yeah. But about the sense of, like, Whangarei and 116 as this wonderful thing, and it's, I've been sort of organising little gigs with friends and things like that all through high school, and that sort of, oh, well, our band won't be able to bring enough people to cover the cost of the venue, but if we bring three other people in, and all of those sorts of things, and the fun of that, and some of those guys have now moved to Wellington as well, and they all get more gigs than me. It's humiliating.
Oh.
But yeah, the there is a smallness to Whangarei, but it's a very charming one, and I think Fringe in that sort of everyone just doing things because they can and because they want to is really wonderful.
You really have to make your own fun in this town.
Yeah,
and luckily for us, this is fun. Like, this is how we have fun.
Exactly.
Wellington's probably a bit of a different beast. It's a bit more, perhaps a bit more competitive, but more like you've got a harder to get gigs. Would you say, or
it's funny. I haven't. I think in any sort of situation where you're trying to get gigs and organise things, it's about who you know. I don't really know anyone yet because I haven't been. I've sort of been really lax as far as gigging goes and really fallen behind on that. I don't know. I've heard a couple of people who I do know talk about, like, there are some slightly gatekeepy elements to everything. But I've also heard that there's a lot of really lovely, supportive people. And I don't really know enough to say either way.
So is that your main reason for moving to Wellington to pursue this? Is that your kind of... is that what you're doing down there?
Yeah, I'm a music student as well, and so
at the university.
Yeah.
Is it Vic have a music program?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different world. It's funny that just a completely different approach to music from people who've actually learned music.
So what sort of is it done by style or genre, or like is it just more like a what's the background to it?
It's very classical centered and very, I won't say anything disparaging about it. It's just a completely different sort of an approach to everything than anything I've ever learned.
But music for you was the obvious thing to study? Like, you was, is that right?
Yeah, it is a sort of a... It always sounds a bit... sort of ill-advised to say that I want to be a musician and that I'm trying to make that work as something. I work at a Countdown now, by the way.
Well, I mean, surely this is the time of life when you can say and do things like that.
And it does become a sense of sort of, okay, so maybe it is ill-advised, but I also can't think of anything else I'd be doing.
I always think some people say you've got to have a backup plan. Have you ever heard that? You know, you've got to have something to fall back on. And I think, actually, you probably just need to not have a backup plan, because that's what you'll end up doing.
Mm.
Just focus on what you're really passionate about.
Mm.
Anyway, let's have a song. So if you grab your guitar, what are you going to play for us now?
I just...
Make sure it's in tune. Is this one from the new album, which is called Separate Ways?
Yeah, we might as well do a song from the album.
Which one?
We'll do... I'll do the one I'm sort of most proud of. That one involves a bit of shouting.
That's okay. Shouting's great.
It's
a soundproof studio. Just
try not to clip the mics.
And there's nothing else on for us to disturb or disrupt. So what's the song called?
This is a song called Pistols at Dawn.
Okay, and what's the... Why is it a favourite? Like, what do you like about it? What's your...
I don't know. It's just one of those ones where I could, like, hear a version of it in my head, and then I tried to write that, and... It sort of came through as I was intending it to. And
what's it about? Is it about a duel?
It's about closure, I guess. It's about, like, sort of going through a breakup and being a bit of an idiot and not knowing how these things work, and feeling like there should be some kind of a cinematic...
kind of climax or denouement or whatever you call it.
Yeah, like it should work like it does in the movies and the TV shows, you know, it should, and the books, and it should feel like, oh, it's over and it's definitively over and I've had vindication and all these things, and I know, like, who was in the right or whatever.
Yeah.
It's
never that, it's always more messy than that, though, right?
Or even messiness would make more sense than just something existing one day and not existing the next sort of a thing, and it's just, okay. That's how the life is, sort of a sense.
So the song is an attempt to get closure from that, would you say?
It's the song's a feeling of wanting it, I think. I'm sort of hesitant to say that any sort of song's about...
anything.
Just did it there. I definitely write things about things. And I can't not, and I sort of tend to be a bit on the nose about everything.
Mm-hmm.
But... I feel like saying that this is a song about a breakup, whereas if it was about a specific thing, no one else would find anything appealing in it. And what it's actually always about is the feelings in that, and that's what's being expressed. And I didn't. The sentence needs closure now.
All right, let's
play the song.
Let's play the song. All right.
Do we need to think about mic positioning?
I think I'll just put my mic over nearer you.
All right. Hope everyone's enjoying it.
That should be fine.
Oh, what has become of the plans that were made? What was the point of the rain? Who's collecting the spoils from the wars you've won, or so you say? Who's gonna pay for the flowers on my grave? 'Cause I'm not quite sure. But I don't think you're gonna tell me. So come on, Pistols at Dawn. Oh, let's settle this gently. Oh, we haven't talked, I think, in a number of years, except for once very brief on the streets, at the same traffic light with a few awkward stares and almost half of an effort to speak. You said you were pursuing a career on the stage, and it's going great from what I could tell. Oh, the act you put on to say you're doing okay deserved an Oscar by itself, and I wasn't quite sure. I think you wanted to hate me then, so come on, pistols at dawn. Oh baby, let's settle this like gentlemen. Oh, and I've never needed advice on how best to fuck something up. And I've never been quick on the draw. Feel free, shoot me down, 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 down. The war, almost 2 decades on Earth, so I should be done with this by now. It took me years to get over what you left me with, and a month you under someone else. And I'm not trying to win nothing back with no song, and I'm not trying to score no points neither. It's just the victory parades and the poppies are gone, and I'm still not sure who was the winner. Oh, and I'd like to know how you're sleeping at night with all of those crimes you committed. And I'd like to know how one handles this right once all the sanitized history's been written. See the pistols at dawn, or fucking coffee and cake at the library.
That was Patrick Biss from Cicada singing Pistols at Dawn. That was a great interview, and it went on a bit longer, and we got heavily into how great the album New Skin for the Old Ceremony by Leonard Cohen is, which might have been a bit niche, but anyway, here's a track while I line up the next interview. I haven't even decided who it's going to be yet, so it'll be a surprise to both of us. We'll be right back. Hope that cheered you up on a Sunday morning. It's a beautiful day out there, and I'm in the studio with no windows, so I'll be out of here at 12. And till then, I'm just playing back some of my favorite interviews or extracts from interviews from the last 2 weeks. And that was, did I say Del Rey by Sola Rosa? No, I don't think I did. Next, I'm going to play a bit from Saturday, the 9th of October. Had a great day of interviews that day, and it kicked off with this one with Barney Duncan, whose show Barney Duncan is Funny for 1 hour was on that night.
I'm going to be with you till 12 o'clock, and we've got a great lineup of guests this morning coming in at nicely spaced intervals, so I've got time to get my shit together. Because yesterday was a bit messy at times with the technology, but hopefully today it's all going to be straightforward acoustic. We've got two bands coming in, Laldi and King Tide, and hopefully they can just play acoustic in the studio because that's the most straightforward way to do it. All right, so I'd like to welcome Barney Duncan to the studio, and he's here with his friend Laurel. Welcome, Barney.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I was just saying to Barney, you know, we've been looking at his picture in the program, and it looks like some quite sort of outrageous earrings hanging down with the sunglasses, and apparently that's an all-in-one kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a new type of sunglasses technology, which means you have earrings built into them. You don't need to pierce.
And can you change the earrings? Or
no, you just have to buy new sunglasses with different earrings.
And is it like $2 shop? Or is it?
It's $2 shop.
Right, yeah. Right, great.
They're not even mine. I think they're my girlfriend's. I found them right before the photo shoot and thought, these will be good.
Yeah, because you look quite famous. I mean, you look like a superstar in that photo.
Thank you.
Yeah. And your description describes you as a superstar. It's pretty...
Does it?
Well, yeah.
Can you read it out to me?
It says, Barney's been making funny shows now for 2 decades and has toured them all over the world.
So I do. I dropped the, world tour vibe.
Yeah, well, why not? And it's probably true.
Yep.
Yeah, great. And Matt, Laurel's partner, was at your comedy, was it open mic night?
It was an open mic night, yeah.
Where you did a bit of material.
Yep. And he tested out some stuff.
Yeah, he described a particular bit that really worked for him, which was the Amazonian butterflies harassing the turtles to make them cry to drink their tears because they've got a sodium deficiency.
Yeah.
Is that like a representative sort of chunk of your comedy?
Shit. Okay, yeah. That wasn't going to go in the hour tonight, but maybe I have to put it in now.
Well, I think I'm coming tonight, and I definitely want to hear it. So if you don't mind, just indulge.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, that's... I mean, that is a good bit. That's a bit from an existing show, Bunny.
Oh.
So what I'm doing tonight is basically like 80% new stuff, buttressed by old classic hits that work well.
Right.
And the butterflies is one of them.
Right. So is that like an extended sort of story or riff, or like was that just a kind of like a gag, or like how would you describe it?
Well, in the show that it's from, it makes sense because it's about crying.
Ah.
And that show is about me dealing with grief.
Ah.
But I can pull it out and just make it like an interesting animal fact.
Right, right, okay.
But this show has no coherence that you will all come to tonight.
Right. Well the only claim you're making is that you're funny for 1 hour, which is actually quite a huge claim, isn't it? Like, it's quite a brave thing to say.
I'm laying down the gauntlet. I do have one piece of coherence that I want to try and get someone... Oh, maybe I shouldn't give this away. I will. I want to get someone to have a stopwatch on their phone from the moment I come out.
Oh. And is it
make
money?
Sure that I do, because I can't pull out at like 50 minutes and go, well, that's basically a show.
Yeah, because limp endings aren't good, are they?
And I have to do 60 full minutes.
Right.
So I'm going to be rigorously, and if I run out of material, then I will be improvising.
Ah.
No, but that won't happen.
No?
I've got bags of stuff.
Okay. So you can easily go for an hour.
I reckon, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And what was your kind of, like, I've been interested in talking to the comedians, like, when did you work out that you were funny enough to pull this off? Like, what was the kind of moment where you, was it when you were a little shit at school? Some of them, I was just always in trouble at school and everyone was laughing, so that was their moment? Was it like that?
No, I don't have that classic story. It's more, I was making theatre, which is how I know Laurel.
Ah, okay.
But the theatre I was making with Laurel's then flatmate, Trigvi, it was funny. It was like, originally it was slapstick, like silent sort of Laurel and Hardy based physical comedy.
Right.
And then that progressed into kind of surreal. Then I did a show called Constantinople about the Emperor Constantine's conversion to Christianity, which was in horse racing.
Right, the two are connected somehow?
Yeah, so like, right. I went from funny physical slapstick into like strange, surreal, I don't know, Barney fever dream stuff.
Right.
And then I went into, I did three shows based on a character called Juan Vesuvius, who was a Venezuelan calypso DJ. So I had turntables and records and did like, it was just like, it was an evolution of, I started out as like a theatre maker.
Right.
But always making funny stuff. And then I think it was when I moved to Melbourne in maybe 2014, where I just couldn't get into the, I couldn't break into any sort of theatre scene there. But there was tons of stand-up.
Right.
Every night of the week. And I was familiar with that scene through doing all the fringe festivals, like Melbourne Comedy Festival and Edinburgh Fringe, and you go and do 8-minute spots to promote your show.
Right.
So I was rubbing shoulders with just normal comedian people who weren't pretending to be a Venezuelan calypso DJ. They were just themselves.
Mm.
And then I just morphed into like, well, no one's hiring me to do any, I can't get any theatre jobs, so I want to keep this, I want to exercise some sort of performance muscle, so I'll just go to open mic comedy nights. And then gradually, I started off being a character dude at that, and then gradually just tried. It was terrifying to just drop character work and then just try and figure out what Barney is.
Right.
When I, how do I stand when I'm on stage holding a microphone? What sort of voice? It's a simple thing.
Who am I?
Yeah. it really was like, who am I when I'm just me?
Yeah.
What sort of jokes do I want to talk about when I'm not being a character?
Right.
So that was really only about 6 years ago. But I guess I started being funny on stage about 20 years ago.
Uh-huh. Right.
I was just telling Barney that I just remembered this today when I was at drama school many years ago when I was about 22 writing a review for this amazing show at Bats that still is in my head called Happy Hour for Miserable Children. And that was a Barney Trugby Jeff show, wasn't it? Mm. It was just like this, it was a fantastic piece of theatre, but clowny, dark, unpredictable, shadowy fabulousness. Yeah. That I've got, still got the review in my journal that I wrote about it. Yeah, I'll to dig it out.
How to read
it.
Yeah. Yeah. So nowadays you're not. Does one Vesuvius make appearances in your shows ever? Does he pop up, or are you
no
generally? No.
No. You know, half. A few reasons. I had a lot more hair when I was Juan Vesuvius that made the character work, and he doesn't look the same now that I'm bald. And also, it's slightly problematic in the current climate if you're not a Latino person and you're pretending to be a Latino person. Even though, you know, I lived in South America, I speak Spanish, and it's very much a love letter to South American music, but it's too much of a sort of a hornet's nest of like, is this appropriate
in the sense of like cultural appropriation or just mocking
It's the question of if you're punching up or punching down and that kind of thing, and just when white people who don't have any cultural ties to a nationality are impersonating that nationality. There's now, quite rightly so, some people are going, hang on, are you able to do that? I mean, so, and it's all, like, it's a cool argument that I don't want to poo-poo.
Mm.
I just kind of went, well, I've been doing this character for 8 years anyway. Mm. I'd made three shows. It was just about exploring DJing and comedy.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I've totally explored every crevice of that. And I was like, well, I can put Juan to bed.
Yeah. So I was just thinking about Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen. Like, where does that leave him with someone like Borat? Is he out of date now to be doing or when he did that?
Well, it's an interesting question. Kazakhstan.
Mm.
You argue that, I think the question you should always ask yourself as a comic when you make a joke is, are you punching up or are you punching down? And Trigvi actually had a great piece of a thing when one comedian we know in Melbourne who was making jokes about kebabs exploding, and it was a little bit, he was putting on a funny accent, and it's like, Trigvi's question was, well, does the world need more jokes right now about terrorists?
Mm.
Pakistani people being terrorists. Mm-hmm. Does the world need that?
Mm.
And it's such a good, it's stuck in my mind. It's like, that's such a good thing to always ask yourself.
Mm.
Like when you're thinking of something funny, but it is a little bit on the edge of being offensive to a whole cultural group. Go, well, will the world benefit from me adding this into the soup at the moment?
Mm.
Or is it sort of going further down a like gross path of just meanness?
Yeah, for sure. So who's it okay to have in your sights these days?
Well, just, I guess, someone who's being a dick. I will mock, I mean, people in power who are making, I don't know, you know, I don't, fuck. I don't think I can talk about on air the people that I do sort of take the mickey out of.
Yeah. Do you do it in the show? Like, are you sort of
political? Look, there's a few jokes that bring up, you know, potentially, I don't know, some issues around science. Based theories of how to deal with a pandemic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Versus non-science-based theories of how to deal with a pandemic.
Right. And are you clearly on one side of that?
No, I'm just going, it's funny how people think that, but then this.
Mm. Yeah, because they are very...
A few months ago, there was a very sort of clear division of, I'm in this camp, and I'm on this camp.
Mm.
And I think enough time has passed now where we're all friends again, and we can kind of go, that was weird. but it's kind of funny to think about it like this. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't want to... Again, it's a question of punching up and punching down.
Yeah.
And it's just a slight... It's just fun. It's just cool. I think the art... with making a joke is to not be overtly violent in your attack, but to sort of throw up a kind of silly situation that allows people to look at it, the topic from a different angle.
Right.
And then maybe see the absurdity in something that we were all very hit up about.
Right.
You know?
That was Barney Duncan. Talking about comedy and how to set something up, and it's been really enjoyable talking to particularly the stand-up comedians. And I think I probably appreciate stand-up comedy a bit more than I used to. When it's good, it's really good, and when it's bad, it's horrible. A bit like theatre. Okay, so I'm going to play a quick track while I line up the next interview. I think I'll play a bit of Donald and Rachel from Laldi, because there's a song in that, and it's always nice to have live music. In the meantime, from the album I Find You Very Attractive, this is Touch and Go with Would You.
I've noticed you around. I find you very attractive. I've noticed you around. I find you very attractive. Would you go to bed with me?
I've noticed you around. I find you very attractive. Would you,
Would You by, I've lost it, Touch and Go from the album I Find You Very Attractive. And this one, next up, I'm going to play a little bit of the interview with Laldi and a song by them. So hopefully this goes all right.
To the studio, Rachel and Donald. They're playing here tonight at 116 at 7 p.m. It's tickets are $15 or $10. It's a one-hour show. And you can, if you want to buy tickets, you can go online, whangarei-fringe.co.nz, and go to the What's On page and click on the tile that says Laldi, and you can, it'll take you to the event finder page. You can buy tickets there. So we're going to kick off with a song. What's the song called?
Taken by the Sea.
Taken by the Sea. All right, this is Laldi live on Beagle Radio.
Wonderful. That was Laldi live in the studio. I hope the vocals came across okay. It's a very sort of improvised setup, but while Rachel and Donald put their instruments down for a sec, we might have a quick chat. And the first thing I'll do is apologise for what a mess our Zoom was the other day. I've had some remedial training on how to do a Zoom. I'm still a little bit, I still need to practice off air. So if you guys come in as close as you can to that mic, that would be great. So you've just flown up from Wellington this morning. Welcome to Whangarei.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, Rachel is from Whangarei, so welcome home.
Thank you.
I don't know if you still think of Whangarei as home, but...
Yeah, it's been 10 years since I was properly here, but places don't really stop feeling like home.
And Donald, presumably you've been here...
Once, a total of once.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So to met Rachel's family, and are you still got family living here, Rachel?
I do still have family living here.
Yeah.
Donald hasn't actually been up to my house before, so this is quite exciting on a number of levels.
Whereabouts do you guys, whereabouts your family live?
So out in Nungaroo.
Oh, cool. Right.
Yeah.
So was that song, that's an original song?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's such a cheerful kind of music, isn't it? It's such a positive sort of music. Like you can't help but tap your foot along.
Yeah. That's what gets us going. Like we like things that have got a good drive and good momentum to them. So.
Yeah. And on our previous conversation on Zoom, you were talking about... what was that artist, the sea shanty? Was it you telling us about the sea shanty guy who's reviving the sea shanty as a sort of...
Oh, it wasn't us talking about
that
it.
That was someone else.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah,
well, I guess I was trying to find out what your kind of... Who your inspirations are, who you kind of... Who would you talk about in terms of music that really
influences.
Inspires you?
Yeah, so there's a Scottish band who have been getting pretty big recently called Talisk, who have been inspiring us recently. And they've gone from just really fantastic versions of trad material to they've started to playing on like really big stages, and they're really going for kind of massive dance party vibes, but with trad music, and they're just a three-piece.
Yeah, and I think it's about kind of these sounds which are really kind of grounded in the traditional music of places like Scotland, Ireland, Scandinavia, French Canada, but are kind of taking more contemporary forms. So we really like playing with that edge, and then kind of also, you know, bringing back some of these older songs that, you know, there's a lot of wonderful folk artists in the UK who really have revived the form of traditional song. And then blending that with songs that we've written ourselves. So it's quite a mix of what we're drawing on.
Yeah, and it's really considering who the audience is. Like when people, we want to play for an audience who wants to enjoy lively music.
Yeah.
And the music that we enjoy is lively traditional music. Mm. So we're trying to play trad folk in a way that contemporary audiences will enjoy.
Right, so do people get up and dance at your shows?
Yes.
Oh, definitely, especially the under fives. We're really big for the under fives.
Yeah.
And we encourage that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So the under fives could help the adults get up and shake a leg. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, certainly the kind of music that you feel like dancing to.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And in an ideal world, we would have a standing room set up because we want to play for those kinds of gigs. But at the moment, most of the gigs that we've found have been putting out chairs. I feel like New Zealand audiences generally quite like being quite static to music.
That's interesting you say that, because if I go to a live gig, I'm very disappointed if there isn't, I mean, I call it a mosh pit, but you know, somewhere to dance.
And I think that's where we want to go to, you know, in terms of like our trajectory as a band, is we want to be a band that's about getting people up and dancing.
Mm.
Yeah.
And presumably you sort of met through your shared love of this kind of music. Is that
very much
right?
Yeah.
I met Donald at the party of a mutual friend and was like, oh my God, there's a man in Wellington, you know, it's not as small as Whangarei, but it can feel pretty small sometimes, who's under 40, who plays mandolin, who I don't know, and aggressively befriended him. And
right.
2 years later, here we are.
Right, and I haven't asked you this, but I'm assuming you're a couple, I guess you're...
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so quite a nice kind of compact unit. You're not expenses are quite minimal for touring, I would guess.
Yeah, you know? Especially when it ties in with family visits. Thank
Yeah. Right, so how long have you guys been playing together again?
So we played together in a different band for 2 years
yeah.
uh-huh.
Before this, and then we kind of started, I would say we had our first proper gig October last year.
Yeah.
But we were kind of brewing up to that over a good 6 month period.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we've basically been making music together for about 4 years, because very quickly after Rachel and I started playing music together, I asked her to join the other band.
Oh.
And just because she was keen, she kept saying yes. Yeah. And I'm like, this is great.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's really good. So I just wanted more excuses to play.
Right. So what's happened to the other band? Is that still a thing, or are you?
No, we kind of got to a point where everyone had other projects that they were also working on.
Yeah.
And so that band was called Barry and the Crumpets, and we managed to record an album.
Wow. And is that a Barry Crump reference?
Yes,
yeah,
it is.
Very
yes.
much. Our album was called A Good Keen Band.
Ah, okay, right. Yeah. Are you all Barry Crump fans, or?
No, it was a funny idea by
the front man,
banjo player. He thought, like, right. Haha, this would be funny. He wasn't expecting the band to agree, but no one else had a better name suggestion, so it stuck.
Uh-huh.
And then we were
regretted it ever since.
Yeah, regretted it ever since. Really? because people kept asking, like, so who's Barry? Which one of you is Barry?
And then I joined the band as the only woman, and then I got asked, oh, you must be the Crumpet.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, it wasn't right. cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, it was a good keen band. Like, it was a really good, fun time. It was mostly kind of... more of the old-timey Americana side of things.
Yeah.
Which is really great fun.
It's really great fun. And there's a really big following for that in New Zealand as well.
Oh.
There's a big kind of bluegrass, old-time
scene.
Because there's another band playing today called... what are they called? These guys from... Well, they're from...
A T-Bone playing tonight.
Well, not T-Bone. It's two...
Dusty
yep. and Jerry. Jerry and Dusty. Actually, they're playing...
Oh, great. True. What Fantastic. Time are they playing?
They're playing at 11 o'clock this morning.
This
morning.
Oh, yeah. I think we need to go home, but...
Probably.
Other people, you should go see them.
Yeah,
they're
you
great.
Definitely see Dusty and Jerry. They're great.
You know them?
Yeah.
Yeah, from right. the and Wellington
they're
scene.
Self-described as Americana Kiwi folk band.
Yes.
Yeah.
T-Bone.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so they're really great.
They're playing down at the Whangarei Central Library in just an hour, and it's free. So, great. There's a lot of free stuff on this morning, and while we're talking about live music, so today we've got lots of music. We've got DIY, a punk opera, and Rob Jones is coming in later to talk to us about that. They're at the Butter Factory down in the cave. And then also at the same time here, we've got Huia Express, Joel Reese, playing songs from his band. And then Laldi are here at 7. Black Fern Groover at the Butter Factory in the cave at 7. And then we've got Luna Vella here at 116 at 8:30. And then Kyle Fury and the Ray Guns are at Roost at 9 p.m. So today's a huge... Today's the biggest festival day, so you've arrived...
Brilliant.
Good
we've
timing.
Got, like, we've got
and
30
feeling...
events on. It's like...
Wow.
We're just all amazed that that's even possible in this town.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's cool. So in Wellington, is there a lively sort of scene for this type of music? Like, where do you play? Like, are there some venues that host this kind of music, or...?
The main place to go if you like the kind of trad folk scene is probably the Welsh Dragon Bar on a Tuesday night.
There's a great trad session there.
Right. Yeah. Is it like a jam session or is it like bands?
Well, it's not Sessions are not a jam session. It's a big thing and I could go on about this for a long time.
Right.
But it's kind of, it's a kind of collaborative, community-led music-making space that kind of follows a very particular format.
Right.
Playing mostly Irish repertoire.
Right.
But there's also a couple of really great folk clubs, and of course we've got the Wellington Folk Festival down there, which we'll be at in a couple of weekends' time.
Performing at?
We're kind of guerrilla performers.
Yeah. Yeah. So they
that sounds busking.
No. It's somewhere in between.
So at the Wellington Folk Festival, they have kind of two stages. They've got the main stage, and that's kind of the featured acts that are in the program.
Mm.
And then they have a smaller stage, which is the balladeer, and that's like an invitation concert over the three evenings.
Right.
And that's made up of kind of Wellington scene folk musicians. And then the committee basically just keeps their eye out for any other likely musicians who happen to be strolling around the festival, and then they tap them on the shoulder and get them up to play. So...
We'll be doing that on the Friday night.
Yeah, they've asked us to play on the Friday night because we've played enough other gigs that they've seen us and they know. Mm. And they asked, "Are you going to be there? Because we can put you on." So
great. It sounds quite friendly and inclusive.
It's a really strong community, and a lot of volunteer hours go into making all of those things happen.
Yeah,
and the majority of the festival is musicians. Like my experience of it is that there is as much, if not more, music and good music being played in the campsite as there is on the main stage.
Wow.
Yeah.
It sounds like the music never stops then.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah. You can wake up and you can just play music right the way through, and there's lots and lots of different jam sessions of different idioms.
And mostly that's a good thing, but sometimes people will be learning to play the tin whistle when you're trying to take a nap.
Right, I can imagine that. Yeah, that could be quite irritating. Yeah, and that's a bit challenging,
But overall, it's actually a really positive thing, so I shouldn't make too many of those jokes on live radio.
And also this year, can we tell them about the kids thing?
Yes! Yeah. Actually, so this year, I'm working with Karen Jones, who's a phenomenal Celtic harpist from across the Great Divide. They've just finished doing a big tour with NZ on Arts.
Right.
We are going to be running a youth program. So for 5 to 18-year-olds, we're going to have a series of workshops over the weekend to kind of provide an on-ramp into folk for people who are maybe learning an instrument at school or in their own time, and just to kind of build the next generation. So if anyone isn't doing anything at Labor Weekend and wants a great road trip, come hang out with me.
It's only 12 hours away. I've done that journey many times. It reminds me of a thing we used to have here called Gael Tacht, which is like a, I don't know if you've heard of that. It's like a
sort of
like a festival kind of workshop type thing. Hey, I've just looked at the time and it's 9:54 and we've got Stephen Baines coming in at 10. So we've got time for one more song. Is that possible?
Great. We can do that.
Should we do that instead of talking for 6 minutes?
Sure, we can talk for more.
I'm sure you can. And what? How do you spell the name of that band that you told me about? Talisk.
Talisk.
Yeah.
And if you put on Echo, that's a really great track to play.
Okay.
With a K.
Yeah.
With a K.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then if you type Echo.
Oh. Okay. Right.
Great. What do you want to play, Richard?
Shall we do the upstart set?
Okay, so while Laldi's set up, I'll just tell you the lineup again of the bands we've got today. So DIY, a punk opera at the Butterfactory at 5:30, same time Huia Express here at 116, and Laldi are on here at 116 at 7 o'clock, and it's $10 or $15, which is a really good value for an hour's entertainment. All right, so here we go. What's the song called?
This is called The Upstart Set.
The upstart set. So, okay.
So this is instrumental.
Okay, so no singing. What about the stomp box?
We could plug it in, but
it's too technical.
You have to come to the gate.
We could do singing if you want singing. We could do singing.
I'm happy.
We could do Across the Valley if you want. Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, doing Across the Valley without the stomp box, but they've got a very cool-looking stomp box, which is going to be used tonight.
Yes.
It's a interesting. It's a what? A wazinator. Okay,
yes.
Right. Never come across one of those. And it'll be great. It'll be lively. They'll be dancing. And come along. All right, here we go with, what's the song called again?
Across the Valley.
Across the Valley.
will not carry on the wind. Your voice blows away from me. Across the valley, your song will not carry on the wind. Your voice blows away.
That was Rachel and Donald from Laldi playing in the studio. And excuse me, next up, I'm going to play the interview with Stephen Bain from The Drifting Room. We had a good amount of performance art, I guess, as you'd expect at a Fringe Festival. We had Access, which was interesting. Some people loved it, some people didn't get it, but you had to be there. Plant Lab was also another, I don't know if you'd call it performance art, but installation down at the Strand. And then George Fenn did his Router Sidewalker act event, which took people on surreal tours of the city. And then Imaginarium has been a very substantial part of the performance art schedule at the Fringe, and that's on today as well from 3:33. The Climate Imaginaries, I would guess, would fall into the category of performance art, and that took place a couple of nights ago at the Hub. And Stephen Bain did The Drifting Room, so I'll cue that interview up. In the meantime, I will play a track which is by Hamilton Lighthouser called The Silent Orchestra.
Voices are singing. A moonlight in rapture. But pity and passion are for the children. When you go try. Stars.
That was The Silent Orchestra by Hamilton Lighthouser, and now I'm going to play the interview with Stephen Bain from The Drifting Room. So if you just bear with me while I press some buttons. Here we go. Never mind. Let's crack on with the next guest, which is Stephen Bain. And Stephen is here with The Drifting Room, which I've just been having a look at your website, actually, because I didn't realise...
Oh, I didn't realise either.
What, you didn't
realise? I'm very bad at maintaining websites. Oh. I don't know what you're like.
I don't have a personal website, right, but okay. if you Google Stephen Bain performance art, your website comes up.
Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah, there you go.
And because someone said to me it was quite a coup for Whangarei Fringe to get you here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Which is nice to know, isn't it? And I guess performance art... Would you say performance art is your?
Well, actually, I grew up through theatre, so I was a theatre director and designer, which is why I enjoyed your show last night. Okay. It was really great.
Where were you doing that?
In Auckland and Wellington. I was in Wellington for 20 years, and then Auckland since 2006.
Mostly directing theatre.
Yeah, directing and designing. Uh-huh. For some reason, I wanted to put the two together.
Right.
I actually, this is too much of a long story, but I. Started off studying architecture and then ended up going to drama school and becoming an actor.
Right.
And then, so actually, my next path where I was leading towards was sort of directing and designing. Mm. So I would either do one or the other or try and put both together, which was a bit of a nightmare. But
and where did you study drama?
Oh, down in Wellington, at Twyford Garden.
Uh-huh.
Back in a million years ago, back in 1990.
Right.
That was the time.
So do you know any of the Twyford Garden people, for like Jan Fisher and people like that? Was she after you?
No, I don't know Jan Fisher.
Okay, because it's been going, because it was New Zealand Drama School before that.
That's right, yeah. So I was in the old place. It was a very, which was in Vivian Street.
Right. Was that before it became?
It was a very different place than it is now.
Yeah,
it was,
I'm sure.
I think there was 12 people in my year.
Right.
And it was a bit sort of less... how do I say it? Less pretentious than it is now. I don't know. That seems horrible to say.
No.
What I mean is, it was a little bit more. I don't know. It seemed like a simpler place.
Yeah.
Than it is now. But it's because I've had a little bit to do with it since then.
Uh-huh.
It's become a very big institution now that actually has several different courses,
And
it's a wonderful course and a wonderful different. So I actually teach sometimes on the design course there, which is a Bachelor of Design, Performance Design.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's let's go forward a few thousand years to say that by about 2006 or 2007, I started to get involved with public space stuff, doing stuff on the street, basically.
Right.
And that really lit my fire.
Performance or instantly? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So it would be things a bit like what I'm doing now, little structures that exist in public places. And what I loved about that is that your audience were people who were just in the street.
Yeah.
So there was a different expectation.
Yeah.
And you're also kind of dialoguing or trying to speak to the city itself,
mm-hmm.
and make sense of that whole world, which is in some ways the same but opposite of what theatre does.
Right.
It's trying to make sense of society by looking at it.
Yeah.
Whereas I think stuff that happens in the street is trying to make sense of the world around it by entering into it.
Yeah, I see.
And so this performance is a bit like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about The Drifting Room, because you've got four shows today and you've done one already, 10 o'clock, and you've got another one at 11?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep, we're sold out for 11 o'clock.
Are you?
That's good. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, it's a very small theatre.
So you think of it as a structure that you've got, and it's got the word theatre on the side of it. Is that right?
So it's a magic theatre in the sense that the audience sit inside it, and they're able to walk around with it because it's quite light.
So they're carrying it.
They can carry it. Yes, it's very light.
Right.
But the magic thing is that you can see out of it, but you can't see into it.
Okay,
so
for
everyone in the world, it's just a building that looks like this white building with theatre written on it. For the people inside, they can see their surroundings.
So you can't see the feet of the people?
You can see the feet.
Ah.
That's a bit of a giveaway.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's moving as well.
That's right.
So that's another giveaway, that it's a moving building.
That's right.
But so it's sort of
kind of anonymity for the people inside it.
Yeah.
And then is it the reactions of the people that they're coming towards that, that where are they walking on the pavement, the sidewalk? Or?
Yeah, well, we've got a route that we've marked out. Yep. And what we do is enter into a fourth dimension, which is time. So we actually go forward 100 years and observe what Whangarei was back in the year 2022 with hindsight of what we know in the future.
I see. So when you step inside the drifting room, you're catapulted forward in time.
Exactly.
And you're looking back. Okay, so is someone narrating that?
Yeah,
that,
that's right. Okay, yeah, right. Myself or Sarah Jane.
Right, is Sarah Jane out there?
Yeah, she is out there.
Does she want to come and join
us?
Yeah,
let's see. I'll give her a little tap.
Yeah. She's welcome to. So are you both operating the drifting room?
Yeah, that's right. We tag team it.
Right. So one at a time?
That's right. We had an interesting time putting this project together because we would workshop it every week or so and just have a fun time trialling things. Right. A lot of trial and error, a lot of kind of just trying to make our imaginations work with the everyday environment.
Right.
Hello, Sarah.
Welcome,
Jane.
Sarah Jane.
Hello, hi.
Are you a collaborator just on this project with Stephen, or are you just collaborating on lots of things? Or
we've collaborated on a few things. I suppose I was at the beginning of your the first reiteration of this project, the Floating Theatre.
That's right.
And we actually built the theatre in an old factory space, which we flooded. it's kind of using that same shape, I suppose, but this is yet another reiteration.
So was that a floating, like, literally a floating theatre?
And then it did become a floating theatre, so Stephen had it on a barge in the viaduct, and
that was a very big project.
It was a very big project.
It involved lots of machinery and stuff.
So is there funding for this sort of stuff? Like,
it's getting harder and harder and harder and harder. Well, that's the good thing about doing stuff in the street or doing stuff like this, is that you have a real autonomy.
Yeah.
You're not actually dependent on things like funding.
Yeah.
And to me, that's really important because, as I'm sure you know, it's getting harder and harder to access those funds. And so we have to be a little bit more selective and precious about it, I think.
Right. Yeah. So what sort of experience are you wanting people to have in the drifting room?
An enjoyable way,
right? So
look at their immediate surroundings completely from a new perspective,
right? So you're kind of Stephen was just saying before you came in that you sort of set it up that they're in a time, they've sort of travelled forward in 100 years in time, so they're looking back at Whangarei as it was in 2022, imagining that they're in 2122. And is that an imaginative leap that people are easily able to make? And how do they feed that back to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the main thing is we all go through life on automatic a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And we need these little shakes to go, actually look what's happening around you. And I loved the work of the Situationist International movement from the 1950s, where they would do things like they would overlay the map of one city onto another, so that walk through Chicago as if it was New York, for example. Or they would do imaginative things called psychogeography, where they would just walk around the streets thinking about things and the psychology of a place rather than the maps and the physical things.
Right.
So there's ways of looking at a city differently that actually just spark you back into reality and go, oh, what actually is around me?
Yeah.
Rather than this automatic thing we have of we're on our journey, we're going to this place.
Yeah.
One of the things we did as a sort of experiment for this, so we did some drifting sessions, which is where you get together in a group and then you go nowhere, you just drift. So there's
in what like walking or in a...
Yeah, walking.
Oh.
So there'll be one person leading at a time.
Yeah.
And then you don't try and go anywhere. You just sort of follow your nose. Yeah. And then you follow whoever's leading for a while. And then you become someone, and then someone else will take the lead.
Right.
And what happens is the whole world around you sort of changes because you look at things curiously. You go, oh, that's a tree. Why don't we go and have a look at the tree?
Yeah.
Which we never do in real life. We're on our way to get to somewhere.
True, yeah.
So they're just little strategies to make us think about our environment differently.
Yeah,
really.
And I guess that's the function of art broadly, isn't it? No matter what art is. And the Situationists, I guess they're not that well known these days. I mean, the only thing I know about them is they used to go in the Paris riots, they'd go and put some deck chairs out and sit in deck chairs during the Paris riots in 68. Yeah. You know, like sort of changing the frame, putting a different frame around an event.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those movements that every now and then gets talked about, but it's actually been integrated into lots of things now.
Yeah.
So we do access that work in a lot of different ways.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. So, are you both inside the theatre when it's going, or do you take it in turns, or do you need
one at a time?
One at a time.
Yeah, take it in turns.
It depends how many audience there are,
right?
Because it can get pretty snug.
I was thinking that, not for claustrophobics, maybe.
Yeah.
And are you steering it? How do you steer? Like, how do you drive it or direct it?
Well, we do a little bit of a manoeuvring session at the beginning.
To train people up.
Yeah, that's right. Cool. Yeah. Otherwise, it could be a lethal weapon.
Uh-huh. And what about the other pedestrians? Do they have to get out of the way? Is that...
Well, it's a bit of a negotiation, because suddenly... Everyone in the city is... Oh, you need to go. Yeah,
I need to go do the next one.
Great. Thanks a lot. Nice to meet you. Yeah, we better wrap this up because I think the next guests are here as well.
Great. Yeah, it's a bit of a negotiation. People need to figure out, I'm suddenly sharing the pavement with a building, which is walking.
Uh-huh.
And so that's a bit of a mind shift.
And do you ever get sort of negative reactions? Do people generally just...
Oh, yeah, I like that.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Do they ever sort of, shout at you or inquire as to what you're doing, kind of thing?
Yeah, I've had some interesting reactions, not with this production, but with other ones, where you start messing with traffic. People get very annoyed when you do that.
Yeah,
they feel like the street is for cars. Yeah. And if you interfere with that you're ruining their autonomy.
Yeah.
And so that's really
interesting, isn't it? That sort of mentality of being in a car.
Yeah, so
and people behaving in ways that they would never behave if they were... not in a car.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Exactly. It sounds like a really interesting event. What do you call it? A show? An event?
I don't know.
Happening?
A performance.
A performance.
The performance sort of keeps things open.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's whatever you want it to be, I suppose.
And the people inside the theatre are performers. Would you think of them as that? Or are they spectators?
Right. No, participants.
Participants.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Very hung up on definitions, aren't we?
Now.
Yeah. Anyway, Stephen, it's been great to meet you. Thanks so much for bringing this to Whangarei Fringe. And it's so cool that we've got such a nice, diverse range of types of performance and types of event. And
yeah,
today,
it's a beautiful looking festival. Oh. I went to a show last night, which was very enjoyable, but the whole vibe of it is great.
Cool. Yeah. And today's like the climax of the festival. There's like 30 events on.
Oh, really? Wow.
And it's nice, people like you making up four of them. Is it exhausting to do four things in one day? Or?
Well, that's why there's two of us. We sort of tag teaming.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I'm hoping to catch the 12 o'clock drift. Because it's from here, isn't it?
That's
12
right.
o'clock.
Yeah, yeah.
And are you sold out yet?
They're not all sold out.
Okay, so I should book?
12 o'clock is fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you should book because it's very limited.
Okay. Okay. Cool. Right. I'll try.
And tomorrow we're going to base ourselves down by the museum, the art museum. We're going to leave from outside the art museum.
That's right. Yeah.
So we'll do a different route down there.
Okay. Cool.
Just
awesome.
To mix it up.
All right. Lovely to meet you, Stephen.
Awesome.
Thanks
you
for coming in.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.
So that was Stephen Bain from The Drifting Room, and Sarah Jane, never found out what her surname was, but never mind, his collaborator. And I thought I'd play a track. Oh, no, that's going to mean it's not going to work. I'm going to play one of my favourite tracks by Donna Summer, State of Independence, while I queue up the next interview.
Me, your name. Mars, who played here yesterday afternoon at 116. Just an amazing, good rock show from a pretty amazing band of neurodiverse individuals. Was really just quite a joyful occasion. I was sitting at the back of the audience getting a wee bit lumped in the throat, a wee bit choked up, seeing how much the music was meaning to the crew playing on stage. So it was a really amazing day. So we'll take this interview now. It's about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and start to trawl through all the incredible things that happened over the weekend.
I'm Damien, and I'm here in the studio with Matt, and we're running Fringe Radio from 9 till 12 every day. We've got some very special guests in the studio this morning, this afternoon, I should say. Just played a gig, so they're all hot and sweaty and amped after a really great gig at 116. We've got the Mutes from Mars. Is it just Mutes from Mars or the Mutes from Mars?
Oh, the Mutes from Mars.
Right. Okay, so we've got Jonathan and Lisa and Gabriel. So, Jonathan, what do you play?
Harmonica.
Harmonica, yeah. Right, cool. And also I saw you on the vocals.
Cool,
okay. All right, how about you, Lisa? What do you play?
So I'm now playing on the bass guitar and keyboard.
And vocals. Yes.
Of course.
I saw you do vocals for a song. What was that?
I can't remember.
Was it Waiting for the Man?
Yes, it was actually, right. Waiting for the Man.
Right, and Gabriel, how about you? What do you play?
Vocals, I play the piano, well, keyboard, and I play the bass.
And you also wrote one of the songs, right? The one that we all got up and danced to?
Yes, I did. It was Rock and Rollers. Yeah, it's a good
one. Cool. So you play a mix of originals and covers? Yep. And how long have you guys been playing together?
I started for...
T-shirt. Cool, awesome. Have you all been in the band since the beginning, Lisa?
Yeah, so we started in 2010, so 11 years now.
Wow, that's a long time. And you haven't had any like band member changes or anything like that?
We've had a few changes in the band, so we've had to restructure quite a bit. So.
Have you had any like rock and roll arguments?
sort of, yeah.
Like do you who decides what you play? Do you all just sort of have a go and talk about what you want to sing?
Yes, that's generally the idea. Sam, who's our band leader, he's the final word, so we do what he does.
You do what he says. Cool. And I understand from Sam's partner, Emily, that you guys play a regular gig down in Auckland.
Yes.
Yeah, whereabouts is that?
Greyland RSC. Yeah. Yep, that's normally a regular for us.
Is that like once a week or?
Normally once a month, maybe.
Yeah. It's kind of been a bit difficult because of the current situation with the COVID and all that, but it's usually once a month. Yeah.
Cool. So what kind of music are you guys into? Let me ask you in turn, like what kind of, like, who's your favourite artist? I know that's putting you on the spot, but like who are you listening to at the moment, you know?
You work it out before, but the same thing or have people ever for to do new call for the people, as I say.
Right, okay, got it. What about you, Lisa?
I kind of like Eric Clapton.
Okay, right, Eric Clapton. I wasn't expecting that, but
yeah,
you know.
No, it was last minute.
Last minute decision. Fair enough, and I did put you on the spot. How about you, Gabriel?
I'm a Tool person.
Oh, Tool. Tool fans are a certain breed, aren't they?
Definitely a certain breed. We're unique.
What is it about Tool that you like?
I love the complex music types and the different rhythms.
Right. What about these guys? I've realized I'm wearing my Unknown Mortal Orchestra t-shirt. Are you a fan of Unknown Mortal Orchestra? They're like New Zealand's most famous band that no one knows as a New Zealand band. You know what I mean? What's on your t-shirt, Jonathan?
originally made, he made it from a new to Mars.
But that's the Mutes from Mars t-shirt.
Yep, yep. But it's another for bringing it up, helping it off for the main one.
Right.
But the mate, the odd.
Right. Who drew that?
Because of that, for sugar made it. For the new one, by the new one.
It's quite a cool image, isn't it? It's like a big, sort of scary-looking monster with a zip for a mouth.
So there was this artist in Auckland, and Stuart caught eye and thought, this is really fucking epic. Could we borrow it? And so this lady said yes. So he said, cool, and put them on a T-shirt.
So you've all got a T-shirt like that?
Yes, yes. Mine's a bit. My one's in Auckland as well. It's a bit roughed up though, so I didn't wear it today.
Okay. So Mutes from Mars is quite an interesting name. Who chose the name?
The band actually was going before 2 years before I joined. So I believe it was a combination of Stuart and Miranda.
Yep. And they threw names around. First we became Noise Control, and then. I know. Okay, so.
Right. So, because it's funny because a mute is someone who doesn't talk, isn't it? So it's a silent person. So
the mute actually came from Stuart, who actually thought that was funny.
And the From Mars bit, I mean, it's like, you know, aliens.
I think it's a David Bowie reference, yeah.
Who, is there a David Bowie fan in the mix then?
Miranda is definitely one to be a fan of David Bowie.
And you did play a David Bowie cover, didn't you? Which one? Do you know which one you played, Jonathan? Right, okay. I think I heard Ziggy Stardust when I came in. I'm a big David Bowie fan, so that got me going.
Rebel, didn't we? Yeah. Rebel. Genie as well, yeah.
Not Ziggy Stardust. One of the songs that I've written, I wrote for Miranda, I give reference to Ziggy Stardust in that one.
Nice. So do you write a lot of songs, Gabriel?
Yes, well, I studied music, so I had to write a lot of music, so yeah.
Where did you study music?
I studied music at Unitech up in Auckland.
And so that was songwriting was part of that course?
Yes, it was definitely a big part of the course, and we did a concert at the end of the semester.
Sweet. So could you write a Tool song if you had to?
Wow. Maybe.
It's a very complex, aren't they?
Very complex.
They're kind of, yeah, like someone described them as like mathematical or something. Was that maybe that was Matt? Yeah.
They're very mathematical and based on... it was a perfect symmetry.
Right. Cool. So have you guys ever played in Whangarei before?
I believe we have. Yes, we have. Going back a fair few years now, we ended up playing at the bar. There was a bar in Whangarei that we played at.
Right. And Sam lives up here now, doesn't he? So yeah, I guess this makes sense. So what are you guys all doing next? You going back to Auckland?
Yep, I will work it for by the help me before the new Friday when we make my birthday.
Right. Oh, cool. Okay. So
the band's gonna go to one of the museums. What's it called?
In Whangarei.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's quite hard to say. Hey. Yeah, that's quite a cool building. It's opened this year. It's really. He was a very interesting man. You've got to be prepared for seeing him without his clothes on. He liked to walk around without his clothes on, but that's what everyone was doing in the 60s, I think.
Free man, eh?
He was free. Oh, and look, there's one of your fans at the window trying to get in. All right, well, it's been great to meet you all. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Gabriel, for coming in. Have a safe trip back to Auckland, and we hope to see you at the next Fringe Festival.
Thank you.
That was Mutes from Mars. In for their interview that kind of crept up on me a bit, sorry. And I'm going to play a song from the show Put Up and Shut Up, which performed here during the Fringe and was really beautiful. excuse me, really beautiful. This one is called Dizzy. Dizzy from Put Up and Shut Up, which is a musical that was the songs from which were performed here during the Fringe. A great, beautiful afternoon that was. And I'm going to play while I get the next interview lined up. We're into the last half hour of Fringe Radio 2022. I'm going to play a Baroque pop banger from Rufus Wainwright. And this one is called Go or Go Ahead.
Thank you for this bitter knowledge. Guardian angels who left me stranded. It was worth it, feeling abandoned. Makes one harden, but what has happened? You got me writing lyrics on postcards, then in the evenings looking at stars. But the brightest of the planet is Mars. What has happened to love? So I will opt for big white limo, Vanity Fairgrounds and Rebel Angels. Can't be trusted with feathers so hollow. Your every convention, steel-eyed vampires of love to say.
That's Go or Go Ahead by Rufus Wainwright. What a great track. And next, I'm going to play the interview from yesterday, which I really enjoyed. Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber. And yeah, they were awesome. I hope you enjoyed them if you saw them last night. I feel like it was a bit of a comedy masterclass, particularly from Ray O'Leary, who just does those incredible extended, whatever you call them, digression riff on the most unpromising sounding material and just absolutely makes everything, makes, you know, creates as much comedy out of it as possible. And so without further rambling from me, here goes. From Damien, we're here till 12 and we're having a fantastic morning. We've got Ray O'Leary and Becky Umber in now after Stephen. And I had a great conversation with Advait this morning at 9, and John Davies, who's doing a show, Te Tupua, tonight at the Octagon. So after the show finishes, if you want to listen to any of those interviews, you can just go to the Beagle Radio website and listen to the podcast. So welcome to the studio, Ray and Becky.
Hello.
Have you guys performed in Whangarei before?
A few times at the old Naughty North.
A guy who works for Whangarei Fringe used to run a comedy gig.
Oliver Scripps?
Yes, Oliver Scripps. Mm. He used to run a great gig. He may still run it, but I've done that a few times, and it's always been great. I really like performing in Whangarei.
Was that at the Butter Factory? Was that where he ran?
Yes, and it
was
also, the Butter Factory. Yes. I love performing in the cave.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, the cave,
real Fritzel vibe. And then also here at 116, which is a great room as well to perform.
Oh, you've performed here as well?
Yes,
Okay. Yeah. Do you do anything else like improv or any like stuff like that, or you just do straight stand up?
I do some improv with Stephen.
Oh, you're in the Dice Show tonight?
Dice Show, yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't fill you with terror?
No, it's kind of nice because you're like, well, if this flops, at least I didn't plan it, you know? Like, it's meant to be on the spot, so there's leeway. I'm like,
has it ever flopped? Have you ever just died?
Not in the Dice Show, actually. It's a real nice show, it's real easy and chill and fun.
And Stephen's like, everyone's got each other's back, so no one's there to take you down.
Yeah.
And last, for the beginning of Fringe, they did the Dice Show, and they had a woman on stage who's not a stand-up comedian, and she got 6 minutes on the word cheers. About 6 seconds, she'd run out of ideas, and it was a very long 6 minutes, but everyone else sort of like was, throwing stuff at her. But I guess, and talking to Stephen, it takes a certain kind of sort of presence of mind and lack of panic in the moment to be able to deal with that kind of pressure. Yeah. Would
it
you agree?
Weird. But it's also good for stand-up comedy because you do need to have that presence of mind. I guess if someone yells something out at you, instead of being like, bah!
Yeah. Although I went to see Advait before I came down to see you guys last night, and he makes it quite clear. He's like, I don't do crowd work.
Yes.
So basically, anyone who tries to talk to me, just like, sorry, I don't do crowd. And he seemed to get away with it. I was like, lucky bastard, because a heckler who wanted to hijack probably could. So how was last night for you?
Good
show.
How do you gauge it? Like, what's your sort of how?
I've recorded it. I haven't listened to the recording yet.
Do you normally record it?
Yeah, I've got a recording of nearly every single time I've performed on stage.
Wow.
And so that way I can go back and listen to it and, see what needs to change or see how well it went compared to other times. And, that's the way I work.
Do most comedians do that?
I think a lot of them.
I think definitely, I mean, every comedian, wants to improve and stuff. I don't know if everyone, I have a friend who doesn't record their sets at all, and it drives me up the wall. I don't know how he can do it, because it's so hard to remember every single line went, how long the laughs were, things like that. You can't get a proper gauge of it, and I like to be quite meticulous with my assessing myself. Like I've got spreadsheets and things like that.
He looks like a man who uses Excel. So.
Yeah,
and you've even incorporated that into the show. The personality, what was it? The social skills of Excel or something like that. I was thinking, so I realized last night when I was watching your shows, the joy for me of being taken on a journey, with a comedian like you take us on the Koreans Can't Farm journey.
I'm specifically saying that I think it's wrong to say Koreans.
Yes. Oh, yes. I should add that. In. I mean,
trying to tell him in the car.
You set it up very clearly that it's an old person saying that, and then you just kept going with it, and it was like, how far can you go with this?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And the challenge, I guess, for you as a comedian is to see how far you can go.
Yes, yeah.
And so did that idea sort of, did that, is that something that you developed, or did it come fully formed when you put it in your material, in your show?
I remember when it happened. Mm. I think it was my 30th birthday, and I met a distant relative I've never met before.
Uh-huh.
And she said that to me. She said
that actually happened.
Yeah. She was talking about the person she had bought her property from, and she said Koreans can't farm. And I just remember thinking that's an insane thing to say. And every person I told people that she had said that to me, and like my friends all laughed that she had said that. And so I was like, oh no, there's something funny here. There's something in the absurdity of what she said.
Yeah.
And so then I just sat down and I tried to think of as many different angles as I could on how to approach it. You know, like is there a funny way of trying to make it seem like a progressive thing that she said? Is there I tried to think, you know, what else might she think? You know, things like that.
And yeah.
I was trying to approach it in as many different angles as I could without. My main fear was I didn't want it to come across as a bit that was like sort of like, oh, all old people are racist or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Which I feel like has been done to death, I think, on stage. Or in comics. Yeah. So I guess I was just trying to approach it as many different ways that were unique.
Yeah, I guess that's the fun of it is that, you know, you're sort of exploring it. And like you say, you can kind of look at it from different angles, and you go, well, what if this, and what if this, and what if she's actually quite a progressive racist, you know? And really, you're quite. It's quite clear what your position on racism is. You know, you're not taking
I'm
that.
I'm pro it.
And I also noticed one thing that you both did was to draw attention to yourselves and your sort of physicality. In your case, where you did that very funny line about some people struggle with their weight. I've never had a problem with it. You know, I've no problem putting on weight, which is a way of like, you know, doing that. And and Becky, your thing about your voice, which is very sort of which I guess, you know, you draw attention to it, so you're sort of owning it a bit, like Advait owns autism, you know. He's like, and he incorporates it very amusingly into the show. And so how about you, Becky? What Ray was saying about getting that idea about the Koreans that farm comes from a real thing. Yeah. How about you? How do you?
Yeah,
kind of...
like a lot of the stuff does genuinely happen to me. I'm a bit of a mess, and like there's a bit about where a guy is like, "Why do you talk like that?" And that genuinely happened to me. Like, this voice lends itself to a lot of
Do you get that a happenings. Lot?
Yeah, I do, and I feel like I do have to acknowledge it within my stand-up. Like, I feel like I'll never do a set where I don't have at least one small joke. Being this is my real voice. Like, it's not a bit. It's not a character. I do get the old heckle where they yell stuff out.
Yeah.
You
don't exaggerate it at all, voice?
No, no. This is how it is.
How would you describe it? Like, I know you say a seagull, but which is, you know, you say in the show your spirit animal is a seagull, and very amusingly kind of reincorporated your Find Me by the Dustbins. I remember that. Because I was thinking, actually, don't remember much about... Oh, you go and see a comedian, you often don't remember a lot about it.
Yeah.
But there are some things, you know, that you do remember, like, for example, you drawing attention to your voice and saying your spirit animal is a seagull, and your thing about the Koreans. So you draw on real life, you kind of take things like... Yeah. Is that what most comedians do, do you think?
It really depends. A lot of people are like observational. I feel like I'm kind of maybe storytelling a little bit.
So how would you categorize them? So there's observational, which is... How do you define that?
Observational, I think, is like... Way. Yeah, I think I'm a very observational comedian. Like,
right.
I mean, I do draw things from my personal life, I guess, but I don't feel like I'm a storyteller. I don't feel like I tell stories about my life. I feel like maybe I make an observation and then I try... digging deep into that as I can,
right?
Or I have an opinion on something and I try to explore that as much as I can.
Mm.
But I guess an observational comedian is sort of, I think, like there's like the classic form of a comedian, like Jerry Seinfeld is like,
airplane food. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you go out and you observe something in the real world, and then you
point out, and how it's weird it is.
Yeah, exactly. And observational comedy is often like very relatable. You know, yeah, like Jerry Seinfeld saying, "Where do my socks go after I've done the washing?" You know, things like that. You know, we go, "Oh yeah, we've all lost our socks." You know, that's I think the classic observational comedy. And then I think there'd be dark comedy, dark humor.
That's a genre of.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah,
where you're deliberately going into very dark, disturbing, sort of borderline.
Yeah, you talk about death and the more and the darker topics like that.
Well, there's a bit of that in your show, set.
I'm quite drawn to it.
I try, without.
I mean, hopefully, I'm not. It's not offensive, but I do try. I do find there's a lot of comedy to be mined in dark areas, and especially because I try. I try not to swear on stage.
Yeah.
I try.
Notice that you drew attention to the fact you only swore when the show was over.
I try not to swear, and I also try not to talk about sexual stuff on stage as well.
Why is that?
It's just a personal preference. I feel every other comic is doing it, and they probably do it better than me.
Right.
And then the other is I feel uncomfortable talking about it sometimes and on stage and like yesterday. So I was on. I was on Have You Been Paying Attention last night, a TV show, and my mum messaged me and said, will it be okay for your granddad to watch? And so it's, when you have your conservative relatives.
Yeah, and that matters to you? You're not out to upset your...
I guess I would be nice. I think one of the things that I think is I would like people to, if they come and see me, I'd like them to not enjoy me for me. I don't want them to have an excuse. I don't want them to go, he swore too much or he was too dirty. I'd like them to just not like me because it's me. Because there are lots of people out there who say things like, comedians swear too much.
Mm.
They're all too dirty. And I do think that is ridiculous. I think it's fine for comedians to swear. It's, I don't have a moral issue with it. It's just my personal preference.
Right. And are there some, Becky, there's some comedians who you think go too far? Are there some people who you just don't like their stuff?
There is in any kind of form of entertainment. I suppose. It's just everyone's personal preference.
Yeah. Who do you like then? Who's a comedian that you like?
Oh God, there's so many. Within New Zealand, a big fan of people like Raymond Hugh. Guy Montgomery, huge fan. Then we've got Mel Bracewell and all those kinds of ones. Then there's all the British ones like James Acaster, Josh Widdicombe, there's just so many. I feel like there's so many comedians at the moment.
And James Acaster's name comes up quite often what is it about him you like?
He's a genius. The fact that he did three Netflix hours.
Four.
Just to have that much material to burn within that, and really good solid hours, all of them.
Yeah. And do you watch a lot? Do you watch a lot of comedy?
Yeah, I do try to.
Do you think that you need to? Does it sort of?
I think it's good to learn from. Mm. I also just watch it because I love it. I think that's
what most both of you agree that.
Yeah.
And I think another benefit is that you watch it and you realize, I can't talk about that anymore, or that punchline's been done. I can't do that now.
Right. Right. Because being original. It's quite important, isn't it? Yes. You've got to have your own sort of take. Otherwise, it's probably quite easy to imitate.
I think so, yes. Yeah. That's always a fear if you like someone too much. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to stop watching this stuff.
They're like intonations and stuff.
Yeah.
And Becky, I asked you last night at the club when I saw you in the bar. I've talked to a lot of the comedians who've come up for Fringe, and there aren't many women. What's that about? Is it because women?
I bully them out of the industry.
Is it because they try and get in and it's just a male-dominated space?
It's very male-dominated. I think it's just also something that men are more drawn to because I guess women. I'm making sweeping generalizations here, but there is kind of this notion of there's a lot of confident men out there who are used to being listened to and told they're funny. Whereas there's a lot of women who, there is still that idea that women aren't funny.
Mm.
So I find that the main thing is there's a lot of, the ratio of women at the top stays is better than at the bottom. There's a whole bunch of people starting comedy, and a lot of the women, for a woman to get confident enough to do it, I think she's usually quite good.
Because of the comedians you named that you like, none of them are women.
Yeah,
I noticed. But it's just so. Are there
one of them, Mel Bracewell?
Mel Bracewell. Sorry, was a woman, right? Not familiar with Mel. So, what are the one question I was wondering? What are the careers were you considering other than being a comedian?
Oh God! Well, I used to work in copywriting, so I was doing that and juggling it with comedy for a while, and then chucked it all.
Yes, I briefly... for a while I thought I'd become a philosophy lecturer or become an academic. And then for a little bit I was also a policy advisor at the Department of Corrections.
Really?
Those are the...
So what did you study in order to be able to do that kind of thing?
Philosophy. I just had a philosophy. I have a master's in philosophy. That's all I did. And my friend got a job at Corrections that I knew, and then she put my CV forward as well. And they I got interviewed. I got the job, and I ended up becoming a policy advisor back in this was years ago.
Right.
The national government, the last national government, was still in when I got the job. I got the job. Yeah, and I just hated working 9 to 5. I was very, very bad at it. I'm very lazy. And when I quit that job and I moved to Auckland, and the last job I had, I remember my boss, she said to me, can you please stop coming into work an hour late? And we also notice you're always on Facebook. And I was like, yeah, of course, I'll stop that. And so the next day I handed in my resignation.
So interesting philosophy, because you referenced that in the show last night. You said your favourite book's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, or the Sorcerer's Stone, as they say in America.
I like Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And so when I went to uni, I studied philosophy, or if you're American, sorcery.
And I spoke to Alexander Sparrow, and he's doing an MA in philosophy as well, I think, about comedy. And there's it's philosophy, but it's, you know, and he said, stand up is my lab.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about all these, you know, other things like insult comedy and superiority theory and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, it's an academic discipline.
Yes. I've read articles, I think, maybe on the ethics of comedy, and the Stanford, this is very boring for anyone who's not a philosophy, but the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is a legitimate academic source for philosophers, for academics, has a whole section on the theories of humour and like why things are funny. And so there's one theory is the superiority idea, the idea that you have to be superior to someone else. There's the incongruity theory, which I think is the one that I prefer.
Milk.
Yeah, where the idea is that the reason why things are funny is you've created an incongruity that, you know, people weren't expecting.
There's,
I've seen another theory that it's all about benign violations, that like you have to make something a violation, but it's also benign and non-threatening. So like Seinfeld talks about benign things, but he makes them seem like, you know, violations of the, I don't know, natural world or order or whatever.
Right.
Or there are some people who talk about like extreme, you know, horrible violations, but they make them seem benign, and that's where the comedy lies. There's all sorts of different theories for why things are funny. And
that's fascinating. Yeah. So you studied philosophy up to master's level.
Yes.
And possibly could have been, or could still become an academic. Is that something you still consider as a possibility?
No, not anymore. No, I stopped doing philosophy because I had a fear of running out of original ideas, and so then I moved to comedy, which has the exact same
problem.
The exact same problem.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess what else was I going to ask you apart from your careers? Where do you get your best ideas? Like when or like what sort of context? Is it unpredictable when something will come to you, or?
Yeah, I was just saying to Ray last night, actually, it's so annoying. I feel like I work best when I've given parameters, you know?
Right,
like
limitations are helpful.
Like if someone says, write a presentation about this, and then you've got, and then all of a sudden, in a week, you'll write 10 minutes. Whereas the rest of the time, I'm just like, when am I going to think of a new joke? And they're just waiting for them to come to me.
But I guess if you're tuned into life in a way that's seeing the potential in things, does it come in phases? Like, do you have sort of dry spells where nothing happens, or?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's a good way to kind of stimulate that? Do you ever sort of sit down and think? Because some people are quite disciplined about it, I would guess, and other people are probably a bit more.
Yes, every time I have an idea come to me, I always like write down every idea you have, like no matter how terrible it is. I've got you know, notebooks filled with awful ideas and you know, things that didn't work. Like one time, I was at the dentist, and there was a TV up on the ceiling, and I thought, oh, no one's talking about that. And so then I thought, maybe I'd try write jokes about that. Turns out not very funny.
So there's a TV up there for you to watch while they're doing your mouth.
Yeah, so it was something I noticed that lots of dentists had, and I was like, I don't think I've ever seen any stand-up about that. Maybe I should try write jokes. And then, anyway, it didn't work. And there was like things like that I'll do.
Lots of dead ends when you...
Yeah, even bits, like I've got probably like 10 bits in a big Google Doc at the minute that I'm like, there's something there, and I've tried to sit down and be like and write into a joke, and then I just can't figure it out, and I'll just leave it, and one day I'll come back to it, and then sometimes you come back to it and it just clicks, and then you're like, this is what's funny, this is, and then
but do you guys have people in your lives who you can kind of, you like run it past and sort of go?
Yeah, we run it past each other.
Oh, each other. Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, long car rides. Yeah.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, like my flatmate's a comedian. I've other you've got people in your life. Yeah, you can run it past, which you need to do, I think, and then to get engaged. You know, to make sure you're not going to make a fool of yourself.
And comedians are quite collaborative like that. Would you feel like it's not so competitive? Yeah. I imagine that you'd be all like, kind of like, you know, this is my material.
It's,
and
it's really collaborative. Yeah. Like a couple of my punchlines were given to me, you know, when someone watches you and goes, oh, this is a great tag, you know, just an extra thought on the joke you already had.
Yeah.
Like, have you thought, and then you just chuck it in and then off you go. Yeah.
So that's not... So what's outright stealing then? Is it just stealing other people's material? Is that, does that happen?
Yeah, it does happen. Yeah, Becky stole it all my material.
What do you do? Like, can you...
A monitor. Yeah.
It's
awkward. It's very taboo.
I can imagine.
I think there's a difference between, like, if you're doing something collaborative, like if your friend sits down and goes, oh, I've got this joke about, I don't know, Tyrannosaurus Rex's arms are too short. I don't know, that's the first thing that came to my head. And then you're like, I'm sitting there going, like, well, I don't want to talk about this at all, but I'll help you think about it.
Oh, okay.
And like, yeah, and if I'm watching Becky, you know, Becky does a joke about her voice, you know, well, I don't have a voice like that. So if I think of a joke about it, then I might, you know, Becky might, you know. And that's just how comics think. You know, we watch each other perform, and we're going, well, you're already talking about this, and what have you said this? You know, would that work? And,
So
it is, it's collaborative in that way. And stealing is just, when you watch someone else online or whatever. Yeah, and you just
change a couple of words. Yeah. And you go, no, it's different enough.
Yeah, but you get, I mean, people, you know, get a reputation. And there is a New Zealand Comedy Guild. We have sort of a union, I suppose. Yeah. And that's meant to address, you know, conflicts between comedians and things like that. So I guess there would be, we could, you know.
So if you fell out with someone about something like that, you stole my idea, the Comedy Guild would intervene and perhaps eject them from the Comedy Guild if they were found to be out of line? Is that ever happened?
They're not super powerful. They're a bit like the UN, you know? They're kind
of... But I'm aware that there are people, like, you know, maybe the Comedy Festival, for example, which is another organisation, or the Comedy Club, the Classic, you know, I think they have... I've heard that they've passed down, you know, maybe some consequences for people who've you know, stolen jokes or whatever. You know, like you can't gig for 3 months or something. You know, things like that I've heard have happened. And it's also just, I think the other thing though is most comedians, you know, especially in New Zealand, almost no one does it. One is that we're at the scene's so small that if you stole from each other, we'd be like, oh, we know, you know,
it's hard to hide.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And then the other thing is I don't think most comedians find it rewarding to get up on stage and, you know, just read out somebody else's ideas. Yeah. You know, I don't think, you know,
that'd be acting.
Exactly, yeah, it's like acting, but like, you want to be funny, not, you know. Like,
it's also easy, it's difficult to approach someone and tell them you think they've stolen a joke because there is only so many jokes in the world. You know, there's only so many angles on certain things, and some things are just, like, commonly sort of noticed as being funny. Mm. And then also you watch so much comedy that sometimes people do just sort of subconsciously pick things up, and you know, you think you know, like when someone says something quietly, then someone repeats it louder, and they think they thought of it, but actually they just heard you say it.
Sure.
And so you kind of approach it like, oh, I don't know if you know that this is a bit I've seen.
Okay, I'm fading them out. That's Becky Umber and Ray O'Leary. Had a very enjoyable interview with them yesterday. Just thought I'd, in the last minute of the show, tell you again what's on today. So Time for Our Stories kicks off at 2 p.m. at the Old Library. The Imaginarium's going from 3:33 as usual, and it's the last Imaginarium. And then at 3:30 p.m., Blackadder, the Golden Age at 116, which has sold out. So if you haven't got a ticket, I wouldn't bother coming to that. And then finally, the Fringe Awards ceremony is at, well, it's from 5 at Roost, but the awards won't actually start being given out till 5:45, 6-ish, because we've got to wait for Blackadder to finish before Derek can get down there. He's probably getting loads of awards. He deserves them. Thanks to everyone from the Fringe crew. It's been an amazing experience. Thanks to everyone who came in for an interview. Thanks to Ursula for loading them up to the website and for the technical support from both Ursula and Dave. They're doing a great job of running Beagle. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.